Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind grows flower,
it's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
It's Schoolhouse Rockin', the chip off the block.
Like many schools in the U.S., Killingly High School in Connecticut replaced its Native American mascot. They started this school year as the Red Hawks. Now they're going back to the Red Men. Frankie Graziano of Connecticut Public Radio has the story.
Jessica Long is a sophomore at Killingly. She's not happy that athletes at her school will still be known as Red Men and Red Gals, the nickname for Killingly girls' teams.
I'm even, like, embarrassed that I have Red Men on my gym floor right now.
She's talking about a large decal stuck onto the hardwood at the Killingly High School gym. The decal wouldn't be on the court had the school board gone through with a plan to replace the mascots. Killingly School Board voted last summer to replace Red Men on the recommendation of a tribe indigenous to the area. The student body then chose a new name. They wanted to be called the Red Hawks. But by early January, the board had new members on it, and those new members wanted Red Men restored. They reversed the decision.
The motion passes 5-4.
Norm Farron represents one of the yes votes. He was so frustrated over the previous decision to get rid of the mascot that he ran for a school board seat last fall.
I felt like the whole thing was rushed and a lot of misinformation was put out and a lot of emotional knee-jerk reactions were looked at instead of basically looking at the facts.
He believes the mascot honors Native Americans, but a local tribe called the Nipmuc Nation has told the board that any logo or nickname intended to depict Native Americans is offensive, even if the school or team seeks to honor indigenous people. That statement from the Nipmuc Nation is what prompted the mascot change in the first place. The move was consistent with how schools were acting across the country. High schools like Menominee Falls in Wisconsin and Teton in Idaho, who shed Native mascot names. Barbie Gardner graduated from Killingly High almost 30 years ago. She's been outspoken about the need to ditch the mascot. She's a member of the Chibana Gungamog Band of Nipmuc Indians.
You can't honor someone who just doesn't feel honored by that. Naming a team a skin color in 2020 is just ridiculous, really.
Back on the court at the Connecticut High School, Justin Miato says he's one student that never wanted a name change.
I think it should stay as the Redmen because, you know, since I was born, this place has been the Redmen. It's been a Redmen family, and it shouldn't change.
Now that Redmen is back, 15-year-old Jessica Long is worried she'll be forced to wear something with that name on it in the spring. She plays tennis. She's got Red Gal sweatshirts from last year that she won't wear.
I'm embarrassed to wear them outside of my house to school or anything like that because I don't want to represent that.
Long says she's writing a letter to state lawmakers urging them to ban Native American mascots, something the state of Maine did last May. Connecticut Speaker of the House has said he'd be interested in such a measure. For NPR News, I'm Frankie Graziano in Hartford, Connecticut.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
When your son is poked and called taco, enchilada, what did you bring today, Nacho?
One after another, parents of minority students at Saline area schools shared how their children have been discriminated in the past. Parent Adrian Idaola told a crowd of about 125 parents at Liberty School that his child, who is of Mexican descent, was the victim of racist remarks at the district. While many listened closely with tears in their eyes, at least one person was not compassionate. Listen closely to what a Caucasian man told Idaola while he was speaking.
But I remember when I went to his bedroom to say goodnight, and he was crying because of the abuse that he was enduring in this school system.
Then why didn't you stay in Mexico?
Oh, hey. So, that's indicative of what these kids are experiencing. That's indicative of what our kids are experiencing. Comments like that. And that's, no, he's sharing a story right now. And that's indicative of what our kids are experiencing. So this is the type of community that our kids come to school with.
The controversial remark was made by parent Tom Bertel. In case you missed it, he asked Idaola, then why didn't you stay in Mexico? As you just heard, Bertel quickly ignited anger among the crowd. Many in the crowd started crying, and one woman even held her chest as if she was going to faint. Parent Brian Bright, who is African-American, quickly got up and made a statement.
We're starting to raise these young men and women to be productive members of society. But we're accepting racist acts. Let's call it what it is. It's not a microaggression.
Bertel brushed off criticism and added that minorities are racist against white people when they form groups like La Raza and the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. He also believes that no one was hurt by the comments made against black people on social media in January that led the district to host a community meeting to discuss diversity, equity, and inclusion.
This training is ludicrous, okay? You think you're going to change somebody's opinion that if you're white and you're a member of a group that you shouldn't defend your own group? You defend your own group, and that's
right.
Great.
You're proving my point. Yeah.
No, you're saying some. You think that you can go give somebody a stupid class, and then they're going to change their opinion.
No.
Give me a break.
Jessica Gonilla has children who attend Saline area schools. She was one of the many people who gasped when Bertel made his comment.
It shows me that he's a white supremacist. Everything he said coming after that tells me he thinks that white people are superior to every other race. And that's not acceptable.
I tried interviewing Bertel after the meeting, but he refused to speak with me because he said I'm fake news. He responded to another reporter's media request in the same manner. I did speak with parent Adrian Idaola after the meeting, who took the opportunity to explain what Bertel's comment meant to him.
It's not the first time that I hear that, and it hurts because it's a sign of ignorance. And with ignorance, there's a denial of knowledge. Knowledge brings you acceptance.
Saline Area School Superintendent Scott Graydon says the district already has a plan in motion to address racist incidents, such as the negative comments that were made by some of their students on social media last month.
We started a committee last January, so a little over a year ago, in an effort to really address some of the issues of systemic racism in our community, in our society, and try to figure out ways we can improve. And while we're working and getting a lot done, and we've shared that with the community, clearly there's a lot of work to do and there's a lot more we can do.
Graydon added that the district is still investigating the racist remarks made on social media, and while he can't comment on specific students, usually when an investigation takes place, students are excluded from school until the investigation is over. Jorge Avellan, 89.1 WEMU News.
But Saline is still finding its way through conversations among schools, teachers, and families about the disparity in how kids of color are treated. At the pinnacle of this problem is the question of how a parent can support a child who's experiencing racism. We sat down with Adrian Iraola, who's a retired architectural engineer and the owner of three restaurants near Saline. We also invited someone who's parenting school-age kids right now. Tashmika Toruk is an advocate in Lansing. She works in the nonprofit world, she's African-American, and she has three sons. Tashmika, I'd like to bring you into this conversation. You have three sons.
Yes.
They were going to Catholic schools for most of their school years, I want to say. Can you tell us about the incident that happened in 2017 with one of your sons and how this came to a head for you?
So there were four football players who are now known as the LCHS4 who were kneeling at a football game and during the anthem in protest of police brutality following Colin Kaepernick's example. And the school threatened them with punishment. And so I took my family. I have three sons. I have a currently he's 16 years old, who was at the high school at the time. I have a 14-year-old who was in the middle school, and my littlest one was in the elementary. He is now 11.
Did your son share with you his feelings about what he wanted to do and why he wanted to do it before this became a public concern?
No. No, he did not, actually. What's really interesting to me is I took my children to support these other children and really didn't think too much about it. We talk about racism as a family. We talk about a lot of social issues as a family. I'm a very proactive parent in terms of teaching my children about the world around them and wanting them to understand that our way is not the only way and that there's lots of people living in this world with us. And so I didn't really think a lot about it. And it actually started when my mother came to visit. My mother and my aunt came to visit. And I have a lot of military members in my family. They were just talking about how their legacy as a part being a part of the military for them meant that people were free to protest. And they were just talking about Colin Kaepernick and kind of the anger that other people were feeling. And my son walked in and he said, "Mom, there are some kids kneeling at school during the Pledge of Allegiance." And I said, "That's interesting. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?" And he just said, "You know, just it's to protest police brutality." And I was like, "Okay." And slowly, eventually, he said, "Actually, Mom, I've been kneeling." And
what was your immediate thought that he had been doing it and that that was how he told you about it?
You know, honestly, it didn't surprise me all that much, but I didn't know what to expect. I was hopeful. The school that he was in is probably one of the most diverse Catholic schools in the city. And so I was really hopeful. There's a lot of immigrants, refugees, people of color in that school. I didn't have a grasp of what was actually coming our way. But I also didn't want to impose anything on him, you know, so I really tried to keep my reaction very measured. And I just said, you know, I asked him why he was doing it, and he was very clear about what he was doing it for. And it was, you know, tied to police brutality and racism. And I said, as long as you can speak clearly about why you're doing it, then I don't have a problem with it. Just let me know if you need any support. And that was all we talked about. And then he eventually did need a whole lot of support because the school did not respond in the way that I expected.
Tell us about the reaction.
Well, initially, I was confronted by the administration that said, "We really need Isaac to stand during the Pledge of Allegiance." And I said, "That's not going to work for my family." And they said, "Well, we pray, you know, we stand for the pledge and we kneel to pray." And I was like, "That's interesting, but that's not necessary. I feel like if my child doesn't want to stand for the pledge, there's no reason that we should force him." Then they diverted it to the school priest, that he was in charge of it, and he had made this kind of mandate that that's what was going to happen. And I just refused to compel my child to do that. Eventually, it turned into me finding out from other parents that he was being pulled aside and being told he was being disobedient. Eventually, they decided to have a policy that included all the way up to potential expulsion if he continued. And there were other children who were doing it, too. But he was the only one who ultimately got suspended for a day before they decided to no longer implement the policy. So, it was really hard. It was a really tough time for him.
When you were in the middle of that situation, what did you say to him about the fact that the school was insisting that he not express himself in this way and that he comply?
We spent a lot of time talking about our family's ancestry as enslaved people and how the control of black and brown bodies is something that white supremacy was created for. And so we just reflected on that. And I really just said, you know, if you still want, like, if you choose tomorrow that this is not the thing that you want to do anymore, then that is your choice. And I support you no matter what. And if you choose to continue, I support you no matter what. But we spent a lot of time reading about history and really looking at who his people are and what it means to choose a path. And also that there are always consequences when you decide to stand up and say something is wrong. Even if you're doing the right thing, chances are this is not going to be a peaceful path, that there are going to be people who will harm you along the way. And so it was a really difficult time to have to explain to a then 12-year-old that there were adults in his life, teachers, administrators, principals, all the way up to the bishop, that really didn't see him and wanted to make him invisible. So it was really hard.
Tashmika, you ended up switching your boys to a different school. Did people, were they aware of what had happened? And did you experience people coming forward to say things to you about that after the fact?
There was a wide breadth of responses. And so individually, there were people who definitely challenged me and definitely told me that my child should just follow the rules and what was the big deal and why were we making such a big deal out of it, who I feel don't have a really complex understanding of history or of, you know, what it feels like to be a person of color in this country. So I really felt like a lot of those questions were very ridiculous. And so I tended to turn away and just focus on my child and focus on what I knew to be true about what my child deserved and how he deserved to be treated, and really focused all my energy on pushing for those things and really sharing. I spent so much time sharing information with the school, with the administration about the impacts of racism on children and the historical information that I felt they needed to make a better decision. And was pretty much, I won't say pretty much, and was completely ignored. And so, yes, ultimately, we did decide to move our kids into the Lansing School District.
And how are they doing?
It was a very difficult transition. My children really lost their community. But, there was a moment after there was some transitions in leadership, some good, some bad within the Catholic Church and the diocese. And my son came to me and he was like, "Mom, I think I'm ready. Like, can we go back?" And I'll never forget it. It was really hard.
What did you say? What did you say to him?
I said, "My love, as your mother, I watched the adults who essentially helped me raise you refuse to protect you." And I told him, I said, I can't put you back in that situation again. And I understand what has changed, but what hasn't changed are the people who stayed silent, and I don't trust them with you. And that was really hard. It's really hard to tell a child that there are adults in their life that will not risk enough to protect them. And so, yeah, that was not a good time. And so we decided, that we wouldn't go back. But I will never forget having to tell my son that truth. And it was hard. So also there's the bit that it's very hard to take any legal action in a religious school. So I really felt like, as much as I am not someone who, I live and never sued a person in my life, I wouldn't even know where to start. But I know that if their civil rights are violated in a public school, we at least have the support of the federal government, which, you know, take that for what it is. You never know. You're still a person of color in the world. But I just also wanted to be wise about where we relocated to. And I also didn't want my child in a spiritual place that was not living up to the teachings that they were kind of the teachings of the church that they are. And I didn't want that kind of hypocrisy in my children's lives.
Yeah.
So it was a tough decision, but there were many, many reasons why we left.
College don't mean shit. Y'all niggas, and you gon' be niggas forever, just like us, niggas.
Historically, black colleges and universities are some of the country's strongest pipelines for black scientists and engineers. And late last month, some of that work got high-profile recognition. Howard University announced the largest gift in its history, a $10 million investment in its STEM program. As Jenny Gathright from member station WAMU reports, that one gift opens up a larger conversation about which institutions get private donor money and why.
Ajua Osei-Nsanza wants to get a PhD in pharmaceutical sciences to make sure black communities aren't overlooked when new drugs and therapies are developed. She's a junior in Howard's STEM Scholars Program. She says she and her classmates feel the lack of diversity in their fields most when they go on their summer research internships.
Because a lot of the times we're one of something, either one of the only females, one of the only black students. There's a real need for us.
Howard's STEM Scholars Program admits about 30 students a year. It's fully funded, which means tuition, room, and board are covered. And foundations have taken notice. In December, the university announced a $4 million gift to the program. This month, the university announced a $10 million gift from the Karsh Family Foundation. That's the largest donation by a living individual in Howard's history.
Back, say, 5 or 6 years ago, Howard was raising $10 million a year from all sources for all programs.
That's Howard's VP of Development, David Bennett. He calls the gift from the Karsh family a profound change for the university. But $10 million is small when you compare Howard to some of the universities nearby. The University of Maryland at College Park received a gift of $219 million this decade, and Georgetown University received a gift of $100 million. Crystal Williams is a professor at the University of Alabama who researches higher education. And she says there's a pattern here.
The unfortunate reality is that these institutions are oftentimes not given equal consideration for funding by foundations and corporations.
Some of this could have to do with the narrative that surrounds historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs.
HBCUs are often defined by their challenges.
A number of HBCUs have had to close in recent years. Even Howard, perhaps the country's most prominent HBCU, has had financial trouble. But Williams says there's not enough focus on the areas where HBCUs succeed.
What can we learn about the environments of HBCUs that helps us to better understand how they're producing so many successful STEM graduates?
HBCUs make up just 3% of colleges and universities, but produce nearly 30% of African American students with bachelor's degrees in STEM fields, not to mention about 80% of the country's black judges and half the country's black lawyers. Back on Howard's campus, Ajua Osei-Nsanza and her classmates are already thinking about how they can further that legacy. Because for her, the mission is clear.
To reach our hand back and help other people, help people that look like us be able to occupy the same positions that we do.
The university might say one way to do that is donate. It's been working to boost alumni giving. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Gathright in Washington.
You get that associate's degree, okay? Then you get your bachelor's. Then you get your master's. Then you get your master's master's. Then you get your doctorate. You go, man. And then when everybody says quit, you show them those degrees, man. When everyone says, hey, you're not working, you're not making any money, you say, you look at my degrees and you look at my life. Yeah, I'm 52. So what? Hate all you want, but I'm smart. I'm so smart, and I'm in school. These guys out here making money all these ways, and I'm spending mine to be smart. You know why? Because when I die, buddy, You know what's going to keep me warm? That's right, those degrees.
People who graduated from historically Black or predominantly Hispanic colleges might be paying more to borrow money because of where they went to school. That's according to a new report from a financial watchdog group. NPR's Chris Arnold got an advance copy of that report.
A lot more people these days are getting loans from a new breed of lenders known as fintechs, or financial technology firms. And some of these lenders factor in where you went to college.
It really raised some alarm flags.
Kat Welbeck is the Civil Rights Counsel at the nonprofit Student Borrower Protection Center. Her group decided to run a test. They chose a fintech lender called Upstart. You can get a loan offer off its website. And they applied for dozens of loans online, posing as a 24-year-old man. They said he lives in New York, makes 50 grand a year.
The only difference was where he went to school.
They applied as if he went to NYU in New York, a bunch of other schools, and Howard University.
One of the most famous historically Black colleges and universities in this country. And we looked at what would a borrower from Howard, what would they see if they applied for this type of loan?
And then they compared, and they found that if you went to NYU versus Howard for a $30,000 personal loan with a five-year term, they found you'd pay about $3,500 more in interest and fees if you went to Howard, a historically Black college.
There's no other difference between these two borrowers other than the fact that one attended NYU and one attended Howard.
The group found you'd also pay more if you went to New Mexico State, which has a high percentage of Hispanic students. In a new report called Educational Redlining, the group says lenders may be discriminating based on what college you attended. We reached out to Dave Girard, the CEO of Upstart.
We definitely appreciate the intent.
Girard used to be a senior executive at Google and founded Upstart, he says, to use technology to make credit more available. Upstart, he says, goes way beyond looking at your credit score. There are more than 1,000 factors.
I mean, we're a company that, you know, our entire mission, the reason, you know, we get out of bed every morning is to improve access to affordable credit. So we are absolutely supportive of the intent that credit shouldn't be biased or unfair in any way.
But Girard says basically the test the nonprofit group ran doesn't prove that using education as a factor leads to discrimination.
Using, you know, hypothetical, contrived applicants for a loan who aren't real people was, you know, both anecdotal and not reflective of the real world. And, you know, we're a company that has tested for fairness and bias over millions of applicants. And that's our approach to ensuring that our platform isn't biased against anybody.
Still, the report raised the eyebrows of some legal experts. Todd Baker teaches a course on fintech at Columbia University's law school. He says the traditional credit score approach to lending has its own problems and biases. And some fintech lenders' alternative approaches can help.
Using alternative data can be highly beneficial, but also has dangers. And we need to be very vigilant that we don't recreate some of the problematic practices of the past unintentionally.
Advocates are increasingly worried that casting such a wide net for data to make decisions introduces biases in new and different ways. Welbeck says her group is pushing for better oversight and more transparency from fintech companies. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
That's why we have to think as Black people. Stop singing and dancing and start thinking. Thinking and reading. I say reading is more important than watching TV.
The publishing industry insists they're trying to answer the call for diversity when it comes to books, but this week they fell short. Barnes & Noble had planned to sell a new range of books at their Fifth Avenue store that were being touted for diversity. Classics like Frankenstein, Romeo and Juliet, and The Wizard of Oz. Only the covers featured a range of brown-faced characters. So same authors, just different cover art. And this was supposed to celebrate Black History Month. So, of course, Twitter blew up because where are the Black authors? L.L. McKinney is a writer who reacted to this misstep. She joins us now from Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome, L.
Thanks for having me.
So the strongest kind of criticism I saw of this was that it was a essentially literary blackface. Can you talk about what's behind that charge?
Well, essentially, it's still a story by a white author featuring a white character told via the white gaze. And none of this has changed within the contents of the story itself. They're essentially just slapping a cover on it to, quote unquote, celebrate diversity. But a lot of us felt that you're just trying to cash in on the fact that it's Black History Month. And now, all of a sudden, Black faces and brown faces will sell books, which is just maybe 1-2 years ago. People were saying in meetings, yeah, you can't put Black people on covers. It's not going to sell the book.
And now it seems like they've had a change of heart, is what you're saying?
They've had a change of heart so long as they don't have to actually have any Black content.
Barnes & Noble issued a statement on Twitter announcing their decision to suspend the Diverse Editions initiative. They said the covers are not a substitute for Black voices or writers of color whose work and voices deserve to be heard. They also said that one of the goals for the initiative was to drive engagement with classic titles. And that is an idea you've embraced in some ways, right? Like the retelling of Alice in Wonderland.
Yes. So these are stories that I grew up, you know, hearing and learning, and I've interpreted it. But that doesn't change the fact that the story itself, like the one they're going to put on the shelf, completely ignores my existence, the existence of other Black and brown people. And some of those authors were very racist. So it's just, it adds insult to injury that, you know, this author wouldn't dare include me in his story, but you're going to put me on the cover to sell books during Black History Month. Okay.
When it comes to bookselling in particular, there's been a long ongoing debate, right, about how and where books are placed that are authored by people of color, whether they get, quote unquote, kind of ghettoized in one section or if putting them all in one section somehow helps them to be sold. What would have been a better way to celebrate Black History Month, right, if a bookseller is going to do that, that isn't just slapping brown faces on the stories of white authors?
I mean, feature Black people. That's the beginning and end of it. If you're wanting to, you know, put a spin on classics, feature classics that are by Black and brown authors.
Right. Things, you know, that are, quote unquote, also in the canon, I guess.
Exactly.
Would be a good term.
Like Zora Neale Hurston, Toni Morrison, give their covers updates and put them on your tables. Or if you want to do this thing, you know, where you connect to this idea of the classic canon, we are out there writing reimaginings and retellings and putting ourselves in the narrative of these stories, like Pride and Prejudice, like Alice in Wonderland, like Wizard of Oz. We're doing that. So feature those books if that's the angle you want to go. There are so many ways to get this right. They had to look for a way to get this wrong.
That's L.L. McKinney. Her most recent book is A Dream So Dark. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me again.
Medical Apartheid: The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present.
A new patient has tested positive for coronavirus in the United States, bumping the total nationwide up to 8. Meanwhile, in China, the number of cases has topped 14,000, with more than 300 deaths reported so far. And the first death from the disease outside of China has just been reported in the Philippines. To help us understand the latest, we've reached NPR's Jason Beaubien in Hong Kong. Good morning.
Good morning.
The U.S. has put in place new measures to ban foreigners who have been in China and to quarantine U.S. citizens or permanent residents who are coming back from China. This appears to have inspired many other nations to follow suit. What's happening on that front?
I mean, this really is remarkable, both what the United States is doing in terms of banning anybody who's been in China who is not a U.S. citizen or a permanent resident, and then other countries piling on. You've got Australia, Japan, they're all barring Chinese nationals. Iraq just jumped in and said no one who's been in China can come. You've got Russia shutting its border, Kazakhstan, Mongolia shutting their borders, Italy even saying that they're not going to allow any Chinese to enter. Yeah, it's been pretty dramatic.
So what is exactly the situation there in China? We're seeing a rising number of those confirmed cases, but are things getting under control?
Wuhan continues to be the epicenter. That city remains under lockdown. Visitors are not allowed to come and go from the entire province. People are supposed to stay indoors. One neighboring city to Wuhan actually issued an order saying that each household is allowed to have one person go out every other day to go shopping and collect supplies. Researchers are saying that in Wuhan itself, they think there might be 70,000 cases already, just in terms of the backlog of people getting through the process of getting tested and actually ending up in the hospital. Are things getting under control? I would say no. China is also opening new quarantine centers in Wuhan. They're saying that cremations are the only way that can dispose of the bodies. So there's more this ramping up than getting this under control.
In terms of how it's spreading, has that become any clearer?
Clearly, it's human-to-human transmission. The Chinese National Health Commission, they had a press conference today, and they were saying that the spread is what medical professionals refer to as large droplets. Basically, people sneeze or they cough and bits of the virus sort of fly through the air. And that changes the way that you deal with it. It means that stuff flies through the air, it lands on surfaces, but it is still not entirely clear that that is the only way that it can be transmitted.
So we're getting some information here from Chinese health authorities, and yet there are reports that initially Chinese officials worked hardest, it seemed, to suppress news of this getting out, rather than to act in concert with local and international health authorities to try to get this under control. What have we learned there?
Absolutely. I think in the very early days, they did not want to admit that this was going on. There was an attempt to crush people who were saying there's a problem here. But since then, they have actually worked very closely with the World Health Organization. They have shared what they know about the virus. It is much better than what the situation was during SARS in 2003. And the delays over China coming forward with how big the problem was with SARS was part of the entire SARS problem. Things are much better this time around, even if they're not perfect.
That's NPR's Jason Beaubien joining me from Hong Kong. Jason, thanks.
David, it's been my pleasure.
Welcome to the 100th season of the National Football League. Tonight is not about the league.
What's up, Juju?
It's about football. It's about the players.
This Super Bowl Sunday marked the end of another NFL season. But even as the league enters its offseason, it remains mired in controversy over the long-term health of its players. CTE, that's chronic traumatic encephalopathy, is often associated with repeated head injuries from football. For now, there is no reliable technology to detect CTE in the living. It can only be fully diagnosed after someone dies. It was only after the death of former New England Patriot Aaron Hernandez that his own CTE was confirmed. And a new documentary renews questions about the link between his disease and his conviction for murdering a friend. I spoke with Chris Nowinski about the state of the science around CTE today. He's CEO and co-founder of the Concussion Legacy Foundation, co-founder of the Boston University CTE Center, and is a former WWE wrestler. I asked him to start out by giving us a clear definition.
CTE is a neurodegenerative brain disease that evidence supports is caused by repeated brain trauma. It starts as small lesions in the cortex and then spreads even after you stop getting hit in the head, and causes symptoms that include problems with mood, behavior, and cognition.
What makes it so hard to diagnose?
We just haven't studied the disease as long as we have similar diseases like Alzheimer's disease. We still can't diagnose Alzheimer's disease in life with 100% accuracy, but we have followed people who we believe have Alzheimer's till they passed away and looked at their brains and confirmed that was the cause of their symptoms. And scientists have developed criteria based on that. And we just need to do the work to develop CT criteria for living people, and then we'll be able to diagnose it during life.
Okay, so this is an area of research that is really growing a lot right now. You're the co-founder of the Boston University CTE Lab. Tell me how the lab studies CTE.
Sure. The Boston University CTE Center studies CTE in multiple ways. It started as a brain bank, and so we have 834 brains of former athletes and veterans and other people exposed to repetitive brain trauma, and we're trying to understand what the disease looks like and how we can identify ways we might be able to identify it in living people and treat it. We also have a clinical research arm that is working on the largest studies in the U.S. right now in trying to study former football players, former soccer players, and others exposed to repeated brain trauma and learn how to diagnose them while in life with the goal of eventually being able to offer them effective treatments. We also have a basic sciences arm that's trying to understand the beginnings of this disease and have published multiple animal models of CTE.
So you house hundreds of brains, many of them of football players. Is this something that is becoming increasingly common for people to, I guess, donate their brains to your center, much more common than it might have been 5 or 10 years ago?
It is becoming much more common for former athletes and veterans to donate their brain to our research. To give a window into how much this has changed over time, when we started our center in 2008, we were the first research center in the world dedicated to CTE. We'd known about CTE for about 100 years, but only 45 cases had been confirmed worldwide and published in the literature. Since then, we've been getting increasing numbers of brain donations, starting from about 10 a year to last year, about 170. And interestingly, in our first 8 years, we got 10% of former NFL players that passed away during that window of time. In the last 4 years, we've gotten more than one in three brains of NFL players who've passed away. That'll give us an incredible window into that population.
Yeah. So are there particular cases or stories that came out that really kind of prompted players to take this seriously?
There's no shortage of former NFL players' stories that have caught the attention of various groups. And you probably wouldn't know an NFL player today who doesn't personally know somebody who's been diagnosed with the disease, because we've now diagnosed well over 100 cases of this. Dave Duerson in 2011 was a well-known player who caught a lot of people's attention because he was so successful after his two-time Super Bowl career in the NFL, playing for the Chicago Bears and New York Giants. In his mid-40s, was on the top of the world, Board of Trustees in Notre Dame, and then had a very steep and severe decline, both in his behavior, becoming violent with his wife and children, his business dealings, and going into bankruptcy. And he died by suicide at age 50 by shooting himself actually in the chest and leaving a note asking for his brain to be studied. And I feel like that was a moment that really got everyone's attention because he was so well-respected.
How does all of this information and the dark side of football, if you will, affect your experience of watching football?
So I played football. I was an all-Ivy defensive tackle at Harvard University. And, I can still support parts of football, and especially those parts where it's adults who are informed of the consequences choosing to play the game. But it's also difficult to watch knowing how many former athletes are struggling from those thousands of hits to the head. And for me, what I get stuck on is the idea that all of us chose to play that game when we were children. Literally everybody who plays football starts before they're 18 years old. Most people start before they're 14 years old. And we could not have understood what we were exposing ourselves to at that age. And so it's tough to watch. But then again, I'm also a former WWE professional wrestler. So I'm not against adults doing a dangerous job if they want to provide for their family. But we do have to think about CTE, because this is a disease that's entirely preventable. This is a disease that if you do not get hit in the head, you are not going to suffer. This is a disease, if you get one concussion, you're not going to suffer. It's this extreme brain trauma that we're suddenly exposing ourselves to in our culture, where people are getting hit in the head thousands of times a year as a matter of course, as a matter of growing up, as a matter of contact sports. And it turns out your brain doesn't like that. And so we've got to get on top of this quickly.
Is your message getting through to parents, to people who might have kids who want to play peewee?
The message is getting out there. There's no more heading in soccer before age 11. There's no more checking in ice hockey till age 13. Some sports have embraced this. We're pushing hard on football because they're still recruiting your children at 5 years old to play tackle. And we don't recommend playing tackle football before high school. What's concerning about how the information is getting out there is that there's very clear evidence now that in places of high education, fewer kids are playing collision and contact sports as children. In places of lower education, that's not happening. And so the most vulnerable kids are getting exposed to more brain trauma than everybody else. And that doesn't bode well for, your future ability to think and to work and to achieve.
Thanks to a Netflix series, Aaron Hernandez is back in news. Is there a demonstrated link between CTE and violence?
We haven't yet published a strong link between CTE and violence. That said, in participating in interviews with all of our families who've been diagnosed and seeing that data, a lot of families have a history of a dad or a son who was never violent and then became violent over time, and it appeared to correlate with the progression of CTE affecting parts of the brain that would affect violence. You see the amygdala becomes affected, which controls fight or flight. You see the frontal lobe become damaged. And so you combine an amygdala that's damaged with a frontal lobe that's damaged, you might have paranoid, violent impulsive behaviors that usually would have not occurred. So I believe that it's fair to say that in time, the link between CT and violent aggressive behavior will become stronger. We just need to do the work.
I've been speaking with Chris Nowinski, CEO and co-founder of the Concussion Legacy Foundation and co-founder of Boston University CTE Center. Thank you so much for joining us, Chris.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The gay rights movement is changing everything.
East River State Park sits on 7 acres in Brooklyn with a view of the Manhattan skyline. And after an announcement this weekend, the park will have a new name.
We're going to name the first state park after an LGBTQ person. We're going to name it after Marsha Johnson, an icon of the community.
That is New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announcing the name change on Saturday. Marsha P. Johnson was an influential gay rights activist in New York City. She self-identified as a drag queen, and she fought on behalf of trans people throughout the city.
She was active early and very involved at the Stonewall Uprising, where she confronted the police during the six nights of violence.
That's historian and journalist Eric Marcus. He says Johnson had a central role in the Stonewall Uprising, which was sparked by police raiding a gay bar in Greenwich Village in June of 1969.
It was a turning point for gay rights in New York City. Johnson gave an interview to Marcus in 1989. It aired on his podcast, Making Gay History. Here she is talking about Stonewall.
We just were saying no more police brutality, and we had enough of police harassment in the village and other places. Oh, there was a lot of little chants we used to do in those days.
There was a rumor that Johnson was the first to throw a brick or cocktail glass at the police at Stonewall. But Johnson herself said she didn't get there until 2 a.m. the first night.
Because when I got downtown, the place was already on fire and it was a raid already. The riots had already started and they said the police went in there and set the place on fire.
In the years after Stonewall, Johnson founded STAR, a group that helped homeless trans youth in New York City. And Marcus says that at that time, Johnson and other trans activists needed to fight for recognition within the movement, too.
It was very challenging to win a place within the organized LGBTQ civil rights movement, which was not an LGBTQ civil rights movement back then. It was more like L&G. It was a very different world in 1969, and people were fearful of people like Marsha.
She kept fighting for trans rights until her death in 1992. Since then, her stature in the LGBTQ movement has only grown.
It's a moment to celebrate Marsha, and it's a moment to celebrate how far we've come in embracing the full range of people who are in the LGBTQ civil rights movement.
Marsha P. Johnson's legacy will now be enshrined in a state park on the waterfront in Brooklyn.
Yeah, hold up, shorty. Hold on, let me answer this. Chill.
We've come to expect we're being tracked by advertisers online. It's also happening in the physical world with digital billboards. Karen Duffin from NPR's Planet Money podcast went to one of the most iconic advertising locations in the world.
I went to the heart of Times Square to look at a billboard with Frank O'Brien, who is the CEO of a marketing software company called FiveTier.
What's on the screen right now?
This looks like a jerk chicken ad placement.
Using only an app on his cell phone, Frank can make this billboard say anything he wants. And today, he's making it say what we want.
So when I hit edit, it will launch as soon as I hit save. And there it is.
Oh my God, that's our ad.
Projected from this billboard onto Times Square is the Planet Money logo.
That's magical.
This little magic trick is actually the least of what this billboard can do. This billboard and many other digital billboards are watching you. O'Brien can tell which cell phones are near his billboards. The billboards themselves have sensors, and he also buys location data from cell phone carriers. He syncs that with data he buys about who owns those cell phones from places like search engines, data aggregators, apps. So he knows a lot about who sees the ads on his billboards. He knows age, race, gender, credit scores, lifestyle preferences. He knows what you've been doing before. Sometimes he even knows what you've been doing before, during, and after you look at his billboard.
The amount of data that can be pulled in is really infinite at this point. With mobile devices, latitude, longitude, altitude. If someone's in an elevator, changing an ad based on the floor that they're on in the elevator.
Say you go up to the third floor of a mall. They might know from your Google searches that you've been looking for shoes. So they make the billboard on that floor say, shoes are 20% off at Macy's. O'Brien says, don't worry, most of the data is anonymized, unless you've opted in to share your data, which sometimes just happens when you click agree on some terms and services agreement. At that point, he can track you and target ads at you very personally. O'Brien is very excited about this. He says it leads to much more relevant ads. But me, not so much. Like, I know the ways in which it does make my life easier, but I know that I'm paying a price for it, which is the willingness to allow myself to be monitored most of the, pretty much all day, every day.
That's great. It's great. It's great to hear. And I think that...
Why is that great to hear?
Because you show an acceptance in some way.
I mean, it doesn't feel like acceptance to me. It feels like resignation.
Oh my God, there you are again with another great question.
You can't flatter me on this. It's not acceptance. It's like, it is resignation. It's a thing that's going to happen whether or not I like it.
And from the caveman days, you know, you can't change if it's going to rain today or if it's going to be sunny tomorrow. So, okay, I'll agree that, you know, resignation, I concede. But it's the same resignation as, shoot, it's raining outside.
No, because this is in our control. I can't control the rain. Can you control the rain? He cannot. But if it does rain, his billboards will be happy to tell you about a discount umbrella just around the corner. And if all of this makes you nervous, not excited, you can always change the privacy settings on your cell phone. But the reality is, you're really only as private as your least private app. Karen Duffin, NPR News. Life is depending how you
dress her. So if the devil wear Prada. In late 2018, luxury fashion house Prada came under fire for a racist window display in its flagship shop in Soho.
I saw these two figurines. They were about 3 feet tall with dark pitch black skin, huge exaggerated red lips, and other features that were an unmistakable reference to blackface.
That's Chinyere Ezie, a staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. She was outraged when she saw the blackface designs and posted an image to social media using hashtags like Boycott Prada and Stop Blackface. Her post went viral, and the brand apologized and removed the products from its stores.
It's been far too long that luxury fashion houses have operated like Jim Crow workplaces, where Black creators need not apply, and where the Black consumer public just didn't matter at all and could be openly demeaned. And I think that having racism baked into the fabric of an industry is always going to be a problem.
After investigating the brand for over a year, the New York City Commission on Human Rights reached an agreement with Prada this week, requiring employees both in New York City and executives in Milan to undergo racial equity training. The company is also required to hire a diversity and inclusion officer under this agreement. For more on this, we're joined by Jen Chung, executive editor of Gothamist, who's been following this story closely. Hi, Jen.
Hello.
This is kind of an extraordinary agreement, isn't it?
It's definitely a landmark deal. The Commission on Human Rights, you know, is definitely looking at, you know, making sure that the civil rights of New Yorkers aren't violated. And it's incredibly unusual for a city agency, essentially, to be able to force an international brand to make this kind of huge step in sort of examining their own culture and, you know, making huge promises like not only that racial equity training for employees in both New York and Italy, but also committing to hiring a diversity officer, a scholarship program to be able to bring in those underrepresented minorities into the, you know, showrooms and the company to make those decisions. And, you know, another part is that they actually have to report their findings to the commission, and the commission will decide if Prada is doing enough.
I think for some people who aren't paying close attention to what happens here in New York, the power of this agency may come as a surprise.
Yeah, and I think it's also surprising to people in the fashion industry because never before has a fashion brand also been taken to task with the law behind it. You know, every time, and unfortunately, there are constant incidents of fashion brands, you know, appropriating other cultures, you know, using terrible imagery and claiming, oh, we had no idea this would offend people. And they just apologize.
Sorry if you were offended.
Exactly. The furor dies down and then they get to move on. And they're still dressing the same celebrities. They still have their hundreds of stores or, you know, places where they're selling their products. They're still selling things online. And, you know, that gets swept under the rug and forgotten.
You use the word of cultural appropriation, which certainly on social media and in the broader racial discourse, these are serious issues, but also highly subjective, right? So is this something that the New York City Commission on Human Rights is also being accused of, is like wading into highly gray areas of policing how people express themselves?
What I think is unique about the Prada situation is that Chinyere, who is a civil rights attorney as well, she had just gone to the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. And she went to their exhibit on blackface. And you're at a museum and you think, this is all in the past, seeing these like figures with Sambo. And, you know, it's a very ugly part of our history. And then to be walking on the street in Soho and see a Prada super high-end store that is really promoting this aspirational, you know, like idea of beauty to people, and to see these figures and to be confronted with it, and they looked literally exactly like the kinds of things she had seen in the museum, to see it side by side was really startling. And I think having that put out there, I can't imagine anyone not being, you know, offended by that.
Jen, I once interviewed the designer Nicole Miller at Fashion Week about the absence of models of color on the runway. And she said, you know, I had five diversified girls, that's the phrase she used, plus a redhead, which is the most diversity because they're very, you know, the lowest percentage of the population is redheads. And it's just so clear that this is not an industry known for being at the vanguard of social change, is it?
Yeah, I think that kind of remark, which she maybe sincerely thought she was like really being
sensitive
and committing to like having a diverse, you know, workplace, essentially. It also comes off as being really flip and insincere in a way, because why would you try to make yourself so selective and so special to only a certain group of people? Why would you not want to appeal to a broader demographic and, you know, show that your brand can be for them? Your clothes are something that lots of people want to wear. And
that also requires being able to see them as human beings, right? And having people in your organization who connect you to these populations in a meaningful way rather than in some sort of tokenist way, correct?
Absolutely. And I think that is the structural change that we're looking for in lots of different industries, not just fashion. You know, if you can't even get a foot in the door, you can't be part of that change. You know, companies can't sort of see like, oh, wow, I didn't realize that we would get these great ideas from these different diverse points of view.
Right. They are actually intelligent people. They know something what we're doing in a way. They're bringing something new to the organization. I guess this is why we talk about things like unpaid versus paid internships. Like, who are you able to get in the door in the first place?
Absolutely. So that's one of the components of this deal with Prada, is that they're offering paid internships as well to make sure that people who don't have parents, trust funds, other means to be able to support themselves while they're, you know, trying to get, you know, sink their teeth into an industry that is traditionally underpaid for people starting out.
So is there a serious backlash from the industry, people who are worried that their creativity is going to be sort of like stifled?
I haven't seen that yet. It's pretty interesting. I don't think people want to say, allow me to keep creating racist things without my knowing it. You know, I don't think anyone wants to go there and say it. I think there are a lot of questions about whether a state agency can actually do that versus maybe like a federal one, because, you know, you think about trade deals and stuff like that. But then for me, on that granular level, walking down a city street, I don't want to be confronted with those images. And if there was an advertising campaign, there would be a backlash and maybe the companies would make a decision to take down the marketing. But these are actual products that were being sold, and you could get them online or the stores, and they had a big marketing campaign. And so I don't know. I think it's just crazy. A lot of thought went into this and creating this. And I think it's, for me personally, encouraging that the city wants to see how far they can stretch into this area.
Jen Chung is the executive editor of Gothamist. Jen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Come here, Susie. You remember me? Your daddy's friend, Henry?
No, don't!
The trial of Harvey Weinstein, the former movie mogul accused of rape and sexual assault, has been especially charged, emotional, and tense. So far, five women have testified during the trial that Weinstein raped or sexually assaulted them. The fifth, Jessica Mann, has been at the center of a grueling cross-examination yesterday and today. As Amna Nawaz tells us, she is a key witness in this case, and a warning for younger viewers, this segment includes sensitive subject matter.
That's right, Judy. Jessica Mann testified last week that Weinstein raped and assaulted her in March of 2013. During an intense cross-examination yesterday that left Mann in tears, attorneys for Weinstein grilled her on why she maintained a relationship with him after the assaults. Weinstein's lawyers have repeatedly raised questions about the credibility of his accusers. Now, Weinstein has denied the allegations, saying any and all interactions with the women were consensual. Joining me now is Rose Friedman. She's associate editor at NPR. She's been following this story in court. Rose, welcome to the NewsHour. I should mention more than 80 women in the last couple of years have accused Weinstein of sexual assault, but Jessica Mann in this particular trial has been described as a star witness. Why is that? Who is Jessica Mann, and what is it about her story that's so compelling for prosecutors?
Well, she had the longest relationship with Harvey Weinstein. She was an aspiring actress. When she came to L.A., she was around 25, and she met him at a party, and he asked for her contact information, and they started chatting. He told her he was interested in her as an actress, and then she ended up in this long, you know, five-year relationship with him, which she described as abusive and degrading, but she said he could also be very charming. So kind of, you know, inspired fear, but also could really help her out in some situations. The reason that she's the star witness is because she knows him the best.
So, Rose, what is it that jurors are hearing from Jessica Mann when she's up there testifying?
She told a couple of different stories about being assaulted by Weinstein. The one that he's charged with in New York happened at a DoubleTree in Manhattan. She says she was staying there with friends, and she was supposed to have a breakfast meeting with him and her friends, and that he showed up early and checked into the hotel, and she got a call from the front desk saying he was there. So she kind of goes downstairs and says, why are you checking into the hotel? And according to her, he got very angry and said, you're embarrassing me. Let's talk about this upstairs in my room. So she went upstairs to the room with him where he assaulted her. That's not the only story she told. She told another quite violent story about being assaulted in L.A., but that's the only one that happened in New York, so that's why he's charged in New York.
So in this second day of testifying yesterday, there's this moment we mentioned in the introduction. She's being cross-examined by Weinstein's lawyers. She begins crying uncontrollably, so much so that the judge has to suspend and end the testimony for the day. What was going on in that moment? You've been in that room. Describe for us the line of questioning and how you watched it unfold.
So Weinstein's attorney, Donna Rotunno, was questioning her, and Donna was taking her through hundreds of emails between her and Weinstein, you know, trying to show that they were having sort of a nice, friendly, sometimes flirtatious relationship, sometimes transactional. And they got to this letter that Jessica Mann had written to her then-boyfriend about Weinstein. And it was a very personal letter, and it mentioned a sexual assault in Jessica Mann's past. And that was sort of the moment when she started crying and had to leave the courtroom.
And that line of questioning, though, I've been reading a lot, including your reporting on that. This was something that his attorneys, Weinstein's attorneys, came back to again and again with other women, saying, why would you keep in touch with someone who allegedly assaulted you? Did you see that as a consistent theme for them?
Yeah, that's pretty much their defense, is these women sort of kept coming back to him, asking him for things, letting him help them out. You know, Jessica Mann at some point was having trouble with her car, and his office talked her through it. So people would sort of come back to him again and again, and that's the way that they were trying to sort of prove that these relationships were consensual. Although at some point, Jessica Mann, answering a question today, said to Harvey Weinstein's lawyer, it's irrelevant, all of this is irrelevant, the fact is that he raped me.
So how is the prosecution handling that? Because a lot of people out there will hear that and say, I find that very hard to believe. Both can't be true, that these women would say that this person raped or assaulted them, and then they continue to be in touch with him.
Well, the prosecution has a couple ways of dealing with that. One is that they had an expert witness come in the very beginning of the trial to talk about behavior that often goes along with being assaulted. And what that expert witness said is that, you know, most assault victims don't react in the classic way that you'd think that they would react, where they would just sort of cut the person out of their life and never see him again. That a lot of times people end up going back to their assaulter for various reasons. Another way that they're dealing with it is by having multiple women testify. So we're going to hear from six women in this case, hoping that sort of piling up those stories will help sort of convince the jury that this was a real pattern of behavior, and that no matter what you hear from the defense, the fact that there are six women willing to testify in this case and probably more outside of the case is what's going to tip the scale.
We'll be watching and watching your reporting as well. Rose Friedman of NPR has been covering the trial of Harvey Weinstein in New York. Thanks, Rose.
Thank you.
Who should I make that check out to? 100 grand payable to the Roots. Yes, they deserve to die.
You know, I don't support it. You know, it's hard for me to understand it. You know, I think anytime there's a loss of life, or, you know, I hope that all of us come together and rally around that. And, you know, it didn't come across that way.
The Camas School District has placed the Camas High School principal on paid administrative leave after she started receiving threats online. It comes after a post on her personal Facebook page regarding the death of Kobe Bryant sparked backlash online. Devin Haskins reports.
One after another, students leaving on their own and going home. Parents also stopping in to take their child home after threats made to the principal over her Kobe Bryant post.
This isn't conducive to education. There was the threat of violence against the school. And I know they were planning a student walkout. Yeah. And I don't want him to participate in something like that.
First, the threats. One social media post that the district looked into said, just posted the school's info and told people to do what they have to do. Because of posts like these, the district had extra police stationed at the school.
We take that seriously. And so we contacted Camas Police Department and, you know, had them look at that, investigate it to try to determine, you know, is this a safe thing?
They determined there was no credible threat. Superintendent Jeff Snell said he first learned of the principal's post last Friday and immediately started an investigation. He says Liza Sikora's post doesn't meet their social media expectations.
What we talk about is if it's a disruption to the school environment, then it kind of follows into a policy that we have. And, you know, obviously things like this get a life of their own in today's world, and it has become a disruption. And so that's something that we need to address.
Sikora wasn't at school today after being placed on leave for her own safety. I talked with her yesterday and asked if she still felt the same way about her post.
Do you still feel like Kobe Bryant deserved to die?
Yes, they deserve to die, and I hope they burn in hell!
And that was not my intent. I guess when I think of karma, I think of what comes around goes around. Like I said, I posted the comment before I had any details. So it was in poor taste. I regret that.
That apology rang hollow to some students.
It just seemed really fake and just manufactured, both the email and what she said over the announcements.
As far as what's next for Camas High School, Snell says the safety and support of students comes first.
As far as Sikora's future, the superintendent would not address it. A planned walkout today was canceled and rescheduled for tomorrow. Students say they will leave class for 9 minutes. 1 minute for each of the victims in the crash.
After parking notorious past, what did we have? Niggas worth more when they dead. It's so sad.
The death of Laker Kobe Bryant is rippling through the memorabilia market. Buyers and sellers alike are storming stores and online markets, hoping to snag one last piece of his legacy. Now, they're making a choice: profit from tragedy or honor his memory. Take Two's Austin Cross reports.
Just minutes after news of his death, Kobe Bryant-related merchandise started moving.
fast, especially the sneaker market.
Pretty much the same day that he passed, everything that we had available was just gone.
Candace Gray works at Shoe Palace on Melrose.
That following morning, we got hit very hard with a lot of people hoping to be able to grab whatever they could as far as remembrance.
But while some shoppers were in it for the sentiment, others were just looking to make a quick buck by flipping the shoes online. On one website, shoes made famous by Bryant began selling for well over double what they were just hours before. Not uncommon, says Rob DeGisi at the Wharton School.
When a celebrity dies, whether it be a sports, a musician, an actor, actress, whatever it might be, there is certainly a lot of human sentiment involved, and that'll spike demand. And the market isn't necessarily ready for that.
Leading to higher prices on a range of items.
Shoes are one category all to themselves. Then there's things like jerseys and t-shirts, posters certainly, trading cards.
But DeGisi says the spike is just that. Prices level out over time. That means both dealers and fans must choose whether to sell now or hold on.
You see a lot of our Kobe's right here that we put away. More scattered everywhere.
At secondhand sneaker shop Cool Kicks, also in Mid-City, co-owners Adil Shams and Davon Artis chose to hold on to them. The store stocked several models released over Bryant's career, but minutes after news of his death, the two pulled them from the shelves.
We felt like all the resellers would hurry up and come to the store and take all of the items and try to make money off of his name, and we were opposed to that. We idolize this guy. We don't want people to profit off his death.
Over 100 pairs of Kobe's now sit in a back room.
Kind of has almost like a church-like feel in a way, because it's like, these are the last of the last. Does that hit you ever?
Yeah, as I look, while we're doing this interview, I'm just looking around at the different Kobe's, because you remember the games he played in, you know, why they released, you know. It's hard to deal with, you know, not having the shoe released no more, because Kobe Bryant's gone.
Bryant's fan base in China and Europe made him an international figure. That translates to a world of collectors and fans hoping to get their hands on a dwindling number of relics, now priced out of reach for the average sneakerhead. For instance, Cham says, pointing to a pair of Kobe 1s.
We had it reselling at $750, and now that I'm looking at it, the closest shoe in this size is a 9.5 going for $12,000. This is mind-boggling. This is my first time actually seeing this.
But Shams and Artis don't plan to sell anytime soon. When they do, they say they'll donate their profits, their way of giving back to the man who inspired them for more than two decades. And they're not the only ones putting passion over profit. Candace Gray, who we met earlier, doesn't just sell Kobe gear. She collects it herself.
I have a number 8 jersey. I have a number 24 jersey. I have the OG Pros. I have the Pros that just came out.
And she doesn't plan to sell.
They are going to go in glass. I don't want to have to worry about not having something that my kids can have tangible or their kids can have tangible to be able to explain the magnitude of who Kobe Bryant was.
Though prices may soar, for fans like Gray, memories are priceless. I'm Austin Cross.
Baseball coach John Altobelli was among those who died in the helicopter crash that killed Kobe Bryant. His wife, Carrie, and their 13-year-old daughter, Alyssa, were also on board. Yesterday, John's brother, Tony, announced that a memorial for the family will take place next Monday, February 10th, at 4 p.m. at Angel Stadium in Anaheim. Tony wrote about the memorial on his Facebook and said, quote, "Needless to say, there will be plenty of room, so if you'd like to be a part of this, we'd love to have you." John Altobelli spent almost three decades as the baseball coach at Orange Coast College in Costa Mesa. His tenure brought in 705 wins and 4 state championships to the college.
She's not doing well. May I say she is not doing well.
Oprah Winfrey fought back tears on the Today Show, talking about the backlash surrounding her best friend, Gayle King.
Obviously, all things pass. She will be okay, but she hasn't slept in 2 days.
Let me get you up to speed. On Tuesday, CBS This Morning aired Gayle's interview with former WNBA star Lisa Leslie. In the wide-ranging interview, Gayle asked Kobe Bryant's longtime friend about his tragic death in January.
He will be missed, but he will not be forgotten, that's for sure.
Gayle also asked about his 2003 rape charge and subsequent criminal case.
It's been said that his legacy is complicated, because of sexual assault charge, which was dismissed in 2003, 2004. Is it complicated for you as a woman, as a WNBA player?
Kobe's, he was never like that. I just never have ever seen him being the kind of person that would be, do something to violate a woman or be aggressive in that way. That's just not the person that I know.
The network later posted a clip of that specific moment and people got mad. Even Snoop Dogg took to social media with an explicit message for Gayle.
We expect more from you, Gayle. Don't you hang out with Oprah? Why are y'all attacking us? We your people.
On Thursday, Gayle responded to the backlash on Instagram.
If I had only seen the clip that you saw, I'd be extremely angry with me too. I am mortified, I'm embarrassed, and I am very angry.
And she shared her side of the story.
Unbeknownst to me, my network put up a clip from a very wide-ranging interview, totally taken out of context, and when you see it that way, it's very jarring. It's jarring to me. So I've been told, or I've been advised, to say nothing. But that's not good enough for me. I reached out to Lisa because I know that she's a longtime friend of Kobe's to talk about his legacy and their friendship. We had a really wide-ranging interview. Talked about many things. And yes, we talked about that court case because that court case has also come up. And I wanted to get Lisa's take on it as a friend who knew him well, what she thought, where that should stand.
When Kobe was 24, he was charged with one count of felony assault after a then 19-year-old woman went to the police claiming he'd sexually assaulted her in his Colorado hotel room back in 2003. The case was dropped in 2004 after the accuser declined to testify. The same woman also filed a civil lawsuit, which was settled out of court in 2005. In a statement to ET, a spokesperson for CBS News explained, quote, Gayle conducted a thoughtful, wide-ranging interview with Lisa Leslie about the legacy of Kobe Bryant. An excerpt was posted that did not reflect the nature and tone of the full interview. We are addressing the internal process that led to this, and changes have already been made.
She's not doing well and feels that she was put in a really terrible position.
Enter Oprah.
In the context of the interview, everyone seemed fine, including Lisa Leslie. Mm-hmm. And it was only because somebody at the network put up that clip. And that I can see how people would obviously be very upset mm-hmm. if you thought that Gayle was just trying to press to get, an answer from Lisa Leslie. But she obviously, all things pass. She will be okay. But she hasn't slept in 2 days.
The media mogul opened up about the whole ordeal and got emotional.
I think the last 24 hours for your best friend have been pretty difficult after that interview with Lisa Leslie about Kobe. And I just wondered just how she's doing.
She is not doing well. May I say she is not? She is not doing well because she has now death threats and has to now travel with security. And she's feeling very much attacked. You know, Bill Cosby is texting from is tweeting from jail. Tweeting from jail.
Yeah, you heard that right. Bill Cosby is writing from jail, thanking Snoop for calling out Gayle.
I think anybody can criticize anything, but the misogynist vitriol and the attacking to the point where it is dangerous to be in the streets alone, because it's not just the people who are attacking, it's the other people who take that message and feel like they can do whatever they want to because of it.
Now, Oprah says she's just standing by her friend.
You know, I was on the phone with her this morning, I was on the phone with her last night, I was on the phone with her the night before. I think you stand in the gap, you try to be there for your friends, but this is very hard because when you have social media mm-hmm. and the force of social media, and particularly people who didn't see either interview mm-hmm. Making attacks, and I think everybody has the right to have their opinion, mm-hmm. but to do it with such vitriol is hate and meanness.
Get you a bestie like Oprah. Of course, you can count on ET to bring you all the latest on this story and more, so make sure to keep it locked right here. Until next time, I'm Hallie Stevens. See you soon.
Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby. What's Bill Cosby's Twitter handle? I will follow him on Twitter. What is his Twitter? Does somebody know? Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, February 8th, 2020. So I have been told. Happy Black History Month for those who are celebrating. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts to share. The number 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. That number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Many things to share. We will get right to it. Number one, the COWS 2020 Counter Racist Yoga Retreat, Toronto, May 21 through May 24th. We are a little over halfway in terms of capacity. I said last week, max capacity is 14 people. It should be kind of intimate, so shouldn't be a lot of people unless it's special circumstances. So we are a little over halfway, which means we have spots left. If you would like to attend, the deadline is not until February 29th. The registration is $400, non-refundable deposit that is due by February 29th. The final $260 is due by May 1st. Certainly, you can pay the full amount, which would be $660. All of the details are on my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Certainly, you can send an email if you have questions, need additional information. We will have May 21st is a Thursday. Sunday is the 24th. We will have yoga every day, plant-based meals. See if we can go to the gun range, maybe. Have to check it out. Counter-racist food work. We'll have counter-racist food workshops. Counter-racist workshops, food workshops, there we go, on how to prepare some of the delicious plant-based meals that we will consume. Chef Nadira, she prepared just amazing cuisine for us in Virginia and Florida. She will be traveling north to meet us in Toronto to do it again. I am looking forward to trying out vegan red velvet cake at the retreat. May 21 through May 24, we have space left. We are a little over halfway in terms of capacity. Drop an email if you would like to hang out, participate. Looking forward to being in Toronto this spring. Get your passport. Gus T, I had been loafing. I have never owned a passport, never applied for a passport. I had only even thought about getting a passport when I went to Hawaii. To my knowledge, you still don't need a passport to go there. I went to Hawaii and started thinking about it. And then 2017, we're thinking about going to Cuba. That actually had the application and didn't even fill it out. Finally went and submitted the application this week. I posted a photo online. Really, the primary reason was because I've made so many comments, it feels like, over the years that Seattle is in King County, Washington, and they have all of these images, appropriation, they call it, of Dr. King's image, all over the place. Construction workers, the library, the school system, anything that's got the King County symbol on it, including the courthouse, which is where I went to turn in my passport application. And so they got a huge picture of Dr. King out front of the court off. Now, people are going in to file their restraining orders and taking children from people and everything else, but Dr. King out front. And so the secondary reason I posted, I'd forgotten it had been some time, some years since I had been in a courthouse, that I'd forgotten, oh man, they gotta, you know, do all their fondling and molest you and metal scan over you and rifle through your bag and all the rest of it. Like, I had totally forgotten, like, that would have greatly influenced my decision about the passport application, but there was nothing I could do about it. That was the closest facility, the only facility in my region for miles that accepted passport applications. One thing I noted, I posted about this online, and it generated commentary, more so than I expected, because it wasn't, you know, that big a deal. I didn't get arrested. I was able to successfully turn in the application, and either they'll send me my passport, they said, in four to eight weeks, or they will give you a reason why. Some, you didn't have this, or you didn't fill out this box correctly, or they need another piece of documentation or blood sample or whatever it is. They'll send you a message, and then you can send that in, and then they'll proceed with the application. Anyway, people wrote in, and they said, oh, you should have just went to the post office. You should have just went to the post office. According to the information at the United States, the U.S. Department of State website, you cannot just go to any post office, and that would be valid anywhere in the so-called United States. They have specific locations. They have a whole tab. You go to their website, you put in either your zip code or you put in the city and state, and they will show you the specific locations if you are getting a passport for the first time where you can submit an application. Here in Seattle, they have three specific post offices that accept passport applications. All three of them, you have to have an appointment. That's something else I noted that would also be a deterrent for me. That depends on where you are. I checked quite a few states because I was curious, because that's what I know. Confusion. There seems to be, it's not standard in terms of the application process where you have to go. There seems to be some discretion about what documents they take, what documents they don't. So I can see where there's some confusion. But depending on where you are, in some places you can go to the post office. You don't have to submit an appointment. Some places you do. In some places you can go to the local library and they accept passport applications. I was stunned about that. Didn't know that at all. Some places, they have a local university. North Carolina, I checked. They have one of their local universities. You can go, and they do accept passport applications. It just depends on where you are, how many locations where you can turn it in, and, you know, what rules white people have depending on where you happen to be. Much like racism, white supremacy. Anyway, that was one. And then two, people said, hey, what's all that with the passport? You can just get a real ID and you can go to Canada. You cannot fly to Canada on a real ID. I checked multiple websites. I have been to Canada before, but this will be my first time flying into Canada. According to pretty much every website I've seen, you can, as of 2020, that's the other thing. White people have changed the rules quite a bit, is my understanding, about traveling and what pieces of paper you need, what you don't need, and that sort of thing. It seems they've changed the rules quite a bit over the last 20 years, post 9/11, and making it more and more difficult. You need more and more pieces of paper to travel across the so-called border. But you cannot use a real ID to fly into Canada. It seems that you can drive or go by boat into Canada from the United States with a real ID. However, the Canadian border website recommends that you have a passport, and the specific language that they use is they recommend a passport because that is the only reliably and universally accepted proof of citizenship and identification. That's from the Canadian border website. End all of that. The passport seems like the much better piece of identification to have internationally if you want to go places. Excellent standalone document to have. Real ID, you will be able to fly on that. I think we had talked about that before. Starting October, you will have to have either a real ID or a passport to fly even domestically. That's why I said white people change the rules and discretion and all of that. But the major point, you do need a passport to fly from the United States to Canada. If we have people that are, you're going to drive, you should be able to do that legally. It seemed, what I said when I responded, I would not feel comfortable if I was going to drive and do that, just because I would feel like there would be some discretion. I would end up having some sort of difficulties, and there's, oh, you only got this. Oh, you probably, this is, you know, a phony one. You got some sort of fake ID, you know, you niggers. And then I'd be, you know, in Canadian jail and all the rest of it. So carding, they call it. You go to Northern, it's not stop and frisk, carding. So I recommend get your passport, even if you're going to drive. Definitely if you're going to fly, you have to have a passport to fly into Canada. Next on the list, retreat May 21 through May 24. Oh, and the most important thing I learned about the passport, submit online. That was the most important part of all of this. You don't need to be molested at the courthouse. You don't have to make an appointment at the post office. You do not have to leave the confines of your home. You can submit the application online. It is even easier if you already have a passport. Then you just send your little book in, boom, 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 and it's even easier. I would recommend for attempted parents, get your child a passport. That could be, if you all can do some traveling when they're young, that's great. Get it. They'll have it. If you don't use it, at minimum, get them their passport. That can be like a graduation gift, they call it. When they turn 18, you can get them their passport. They'll have it. It'll be good until they're almost 30. Get them the passport book. Good for 10 years. And it's easy to just do the renewal process as opposed to having to do the whole application from scratch, as they call it, doing it from the beginning. Next, the segment about Gayle King, victim of racism, black female. She did the interview with Lisa Leslie, also black female, former basketball player, Olympian. She was good friends with Kobe Bryant. They both played for Los Angeles professional basketball teams. And so they did a lot together. And they're doing the interview, and Gayle King asks Miss Leslie about Kobe Bryant's rape allegations. Lisa Leslie answers in a very classy, compassionate manner, supporting her friend Kobe Bryant. Suspected race soldiers. They take what is this here broadcast? 11 years. COWS is an acronym for Context of White Supremacy. Suspected race soldiers, they take something out of context and present it to cause conflict between non-white people, have a non-white person, even more non-white people, to be hurt, stressed, anxiety, not well, conflict between non-white people where they have taken something out of context. Racists are spectacular in this effort. Spectacular. No one does it better. Why this program? Context of White Supremacy. Important in my view. Neely Fuller Jr., he recommends, one of his suggestions, resist the urge to criticize other non-white people. We all don't have to agree about racism, white supremacy. We're not going to agree. We're never going to have consensus as victims of racism, white supremacy. As such, victims guaranteed qualified. Fine. I'm not going to call this person a bunch of names and jump up and down and yell at them, scream at them, because I don't agree with their stance on racism, white supremacy. In this instance, I would hope there would even be greater pause because racists are so crafty at showing what they want to show, particularly with these interview segments. A lot of times that's something to even, you know, think about at all times. A lot of times people might sit down for an interview. It might be an hour. It might be 30 minutes. And then they just pull out and show you a 45-second clip, and that's it. Just something to think about. You can just try to reserve judgment, particularly if it's non-white people exclusively. The other part of it, even if Gayle King, even if that's all she had done, she had just, hey, we got Lisa Leslie here, you know, Olympic gold medalist and WNBA champion and basketball Hall of Famer, friend of Kobe Bryant. We got her here. The only question we want to ask, you know, he raped that girl in Colorado. What do you think about that? And then she waits for, okay, great. That's all we needed. Thank you so much, Lisa Leslie. We'll talk to you all next. Even if that had happened, I just said, man, that's, you know, wow. That's a little tacky. Like, they didn't ask any other questions. What about his daughter or anything else? Just, wow, that is super difficult. But still, Gail King, what we saw, when I read books on the program, we read books for the book club. One of the things that I try to point out consistently, even if it's a non-white author, I said it consistently with The Hate U Give. A lot of times you have white editors. They might be the ones that are coming in and saying, all right, Miss King, this is the only question that we need you to ask today. And if you don't want to update your resume like Gus T. Renegade and the rest of the folks who've been terminated, make sure this is the only question that you ask Lisa Leslie. 3, 2, 1, you're live. That's the way that it could work some days. Just important for minimizing conflicts. Whites are extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. And they've been so tacky the whole way through with Kobe Bryant. They had the white principal. We had so many segments on education and the white female principal. He deserved it. That's karma. That word again, I loathe the word karma. That's generally the way I hear it used every time without fail. Somebody, something bad happens to a black person and they deserved it. That's their karma. They deserved it. That coon, they got what was coming to it. That's generally about. It's a little less than half. About a little less than half of the time that I hear the word karma, that'll be the context that it's used. That either black people collectively deserve racism, white supremacy because we're clowns and cowards and we haven't fought back, or Kobe Bryant deserved to die, or Bill Cosby deserved to be in jail, or whatever. It's a long list. Black people deserved blah, 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 because, yeah. Let's see. Speaking of the schools, Tashmika Toro, that was the black mother, attempted parent. She was in the segment where she had her black child in a Catholic school and he was doing the kneel during the national anthem, and it became this big kerfuffle and they changed the rules at the school. And so they said that they changed the rules and the only child suspended was her black son. That's that black male privilege again. The only child suspended was her son. And so then she took him out of school. I just, man, that was pain. Again, I do not have children. That would be another illustration why. Very painful to listen to. And I feel like we've heard that frequently, putting black children in these so-called elite, so-called prestigious schools that are generally exclusively black, exclusively white, predominantly white. Maybe there'll be, you know, two or three black people. Maybe they have a black dog and a black janitor. And this type of thing happening. Maybe they won't be kneeling, but it'll be something. Racism, white supremacy in some element with the child being there. Very consistent. So important to talk to your children about racism. I was glad that she said that she and her family, that they talked about racism with her children. I'm not sure if they talked about it in an accurate sense, like talking about Dr. Welsing and that sort of thing. What definition for racism and all the rest. But having that sort of dialogue with your offspring in an accurate manner is so important. We just had this conversation yesterday on workplace racism. There are going to be so many incidents that happen in the school. Critical to speak honestly with your child about racism, white supremacy, and so that they can make accurate choices. That was one thing I appreciated as well. She said she was talking to her child so that you can articulate, why are you doing this? What are you doing this for? That sort of thing, so that they can understand. I think we have had justice, long legacy, context of white supremacy at 10 years old. They can and do understand what they're seeing about non-white people being mistreated on the basis of color. Talk to them honestly. Use words that they understand. They can think through it. You'd be surprised. Their brain computers work. Next. just on the Kobe Bryant, really quick, not to offer up a lot of theories without evidence, and just to use the corpse of a black person and all the folks who died in the helicopter crash to launch a bunch of wild theories. But I did think it was noteworthy, many things about the crash with Kobe Bryant. Many things were noteworthy, I think, that people pointed out where it seemed, maybe there was something incorrect, foul play, as they call it, involved in this. I even remember many, many time guest on the program, Dr. Niana Rasayan, where he said that it can be helpful to remember that sometimes you will have an incident where a number of people perish. You might have 10 fatalities, 7 fatalities. One of those people may have been the intended target, even though 6 people died in total, 9 people died in total. There was one person who was absolutely supposed to die in whatever event took place. He talked about that a number of times. I did think about that. And there were a number of things that came up where I gave pause about this whole incident. Particularly, I think I shared with retired firefighter, any time that a black person, like an Oprah Winfrey, like a Bill Cosby, says that they would like to make a major purchase in the system of white supremacy. Like, I think it was reported Bill Cosby wanted to buy a major television network at one point before he was placed in greater confinement. It was reported less than a year ago that the Lakers franchise, owned by suspected racist Jeannie Buss, that the Lakers franchise was not doing very well financially, might be up for sale. At the time that I heard this report less than a year ago, there were only 3 names mentioned as possible buyers for the Lakers franchise. And I think I just read the report valued at a smidge over $3 billion last I checked. But the 3 names mentioned as possible buyers for the Los Angeles Lakers were Magic Johnson, LeBron James, who currently plays for them, and Kobe Bryant. I said, wow, that is staggering for the franchise of the NBA to possibly be for sale. And then the only names that are mentioned are black males. That is stunning. I mean, wow. And then this happens. So now Kobe Bryant definitely will not be purchasing the Los Angeles Lakers. I said I would pay attention to the value of the Lakers franchise. Just what happens? The league, the NBA in general, had been reporting bad viewership, that people weren't watching. Ratings were really bad for the season. I would watch post Kobe Bryant after his passing. Are more people watching, or at minimum, more people watching Laker games? Lakers are playing prime time tonight. They get a lot of prime time games. Are more people paying attention to those games for all the tributes and everything else? You already heard the gear and all the rest of it. Just something to ponder. I pondered, just because there was a lot of Sam Jackson, one other thing that I do note, a lot of times in the system of racism, white supremacy, racists will telegraph things that are going to happen, things that are that they're going to do. They'll telegraph it. Sometimes it'll be telegraphed in an obscure manner. Sometimes it'll just be stated pretty bluntly. But a lot of times they'll telegraph it. I was thinking, because a number of people said, wow, the Cartoon Network, they had a dumb cartoon from a few years back showing Kobe Bryant die in a helicopter crash. And they played it back. And I said, oh, wow, I hadn't even seen that. But I have seen that type of thing a number of times. I think they have in the film Long Kiss Goodnight, featuring Gina Davis and the aforementioned Samuel L. Jackson. The main plot of the film, you have to watch the whole bad movie to get to the end. And that's full of racism, too, driving Miss Daisy. You get to the whole end of the movie and a white man says that we are going to blow up the World Trade Center. And we have to do this because we want to change policy. You can't fake this sort of thing. So we got to do it for real to change policy. And this came out in the 90s. It happened again, Three the Hard Way, one of those great blaxploitation films where white people joke that they don't like black people. So what they're going to do is poison the water supply in the town. Jim Brown is in that one. If you haven't seen it, Dr. Cambon talked about it on the program some time back. Is there another one I can give where they do that sort of thing? There is one more I can give. The ISIS papers, Dr. Welsing, she breaks down the symbolism of the game of billiards, pool, green table, colored balls, white dominates. That is in the Eddie Murphy and Martin Lauren classic, where they have a scene where they're playing pool and they break it. It's like they're reading out of the ISIS papers. I have suggested, and some others, this sort of thing. What happens when you suggest, hey, maybe you should check out the ISIS papers, and maybe you say something about, oh, that's some nonsense. That's just some foolishness. People can kind of disregard it. They might not even remember that they've seen it before. I think that sort of thing happens a lot. I could probably think of some more examples where they've had major tragedies, major events, and there's some goofy movie where, oh, wow, you do see that already. Lots of things. Not that I want to take the whole time to dominate about Kobe Bryant, but the system of white supremacy can profit off of the death of black people in a myriad of ways. You heard about the jerseys and shoe. I even had to go back and rewind that. Like, did they say $12,000 for a pair of shoes? Like, wow. Delectable Negro, they can feast off of the corpse of black people in a myriad of ways. And Adam Silver, the NBA, I think they're about to feast off of Kobe Bryant for a while. I think they're changing the whole All-Star game as a tribute to Kobe Bryant. That'll be why. Around the world, I guess that's one more thing I'd get in really quick. Kobe Bryant had a lot of people, those shoes, they can charge so much because globally, when he went to the Olympics twice, 2008, that was in China. It's a lot of non-white people right now who are mourning the loss of Kobe Bryant in different parts of the world. Super important for racism, white supremacy. I say that all the time. We do this here broadcast. Think globally about the system of racism, white supremacy. There are non-white people all over the place who are having problems as a result of racism, white supremacy. There are millions of non-white people all over the world who are paying attention. Kobe Bryant's passing right now. That could be one thing, paying attention to racism, white supremacy as it relates to this. Keep that in mind anytime that we think about, talk about, present, write about the system of white supremacy. It is not local. It is not anything exclusive to this part of the world, global. With that, the number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, questions, make sure everybody gets at least one chance to speak. If you know you have additional comments, just mute your line. Once everybody has spoken once, you can come back in and share again. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just preserves the quality of the broadcast. We don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary audio disruptions. Just unmute if you could try to get to a relatively quiet location. Share your commentary, and then once you're done, you can mute your line again. And if you have additional comments, just unmute once you get to a mostly quiet area. For this program exclusively, I do request if we could not use metaphors, if we could be direct, precise with what we would like to say, that would be super appreciated. Racists are master deceivers. They will take things out of context. They will use analogies, metaphors in a very deceptive manner. We victims have been exposed to this misconduct for a number of years, and many victims, myself included, we are still learning. As such, oftentimes we will substitute logic for an analogy, simile, because we don't have the logic, we're still learning. And frequently when we make that switch, it produces a lot of confusion. If we could just make an effort to be exact, specific, deliberate with our word choice, that would be appreciated. First few folks who dialed in, if you have comments, observations, questions to share, line should be open. Feel free to chime in. I could get in as well. If the person, we were on workplace racism Friday evening, and we got an update, and it was a parent, black mother, attempted parent. She was saying that her son, something happened, I believe, with workplace racism. I think that's what she said. She said she was going to give us an update on what happened. If she wants to give the update, I'm always down for workplace racism. But if she wants to give the update, that would be awesome. I was hoping we could get that in, but we didn't have time. We went right to, in fact, we did overtime yesterday for workplace racism and still didn't manage to get that in. But if she's here and she would like to give the update, that would be super appreciated. Anyway, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Much obliged.
Can I be heard?
Young academic, two-time visitor at the COWS Counter-Racist Yoga Retreats.
Yes, I'm calling to give an update on my praxis examination. I just took it probably about a month ago, and I just got the results back, and I have failed by 5 points. And I'm constantly asking myself, is this a path that I can take that's likely to lead toward success? Now, the teaching agency knows that white individuals who take this test, 80% of them pass on the first time, and 41% of black individuals pass the first time. And so they pretty much know that black individuals have a hard time passing this test. Officials in public education view rigorous entrance requirements as crucial to improving student performance and ensuring a qualified teaching force in the face of unprepared teacher programs. Most of the material that was on the test, I should have learned in high school. But unfortunately, same as today, they are having a hard time finding qualified teachers, and most of my high school was taught by substitute teachers, a job that I continue to do today. And on another note, I was able to conduct some family research by asking my grandfather his grandparents' name, and by following census data, I found out that I am related to the read the book on Kyle's Barracone, The Last Black Cargo. I'm related to Kojo Lewis and my great-great-great-great-grandmother. This is all documented, by the way. She was taken from Africa illegally because the international slave trade was banned, and a white gentleman from Mobile Bay said he can guarantee that he can smuggle a group of niggers into Mobile and not get caught. And that's what he did. How they got my grandmother on the ship, she all of this is documented. They ended up dropping red cloth near the village, and the people will walk up to the ship, and then they put all type of red ribbons on the ship, basically to convince the people to come on. And in Africa, I read that the color red is sacred. So they went on this ship, and then they were basically trapped. And what ended up happening is they brought them back down into Mobile Bay. They police found out, or authorities of the time found out, that they were smuggling captives in. And what ended up happening is the guy that ended up smuggling them, he end up finding out first, and they end up burning the ship to the ground, and ended up sending slaves out into Mobile Bay. And my great-grandmother was actually sent to a breeding farm in which she was bred like a horse by a white man. And that baby was actually, she never got a chance to know that baby, and that baby was actually sold off into slavery. But that is my report.
Wow. We did read Barracoon in the book club 2018. Wow. Zora Neale Hurston mentioned in the audio segment, mentioned black authors that could be read for Black History Month. Wow. The Praxis, we talked, I mentioned workplace racism. We talked about those exams that whites require for different professions, and that'll be another pattern that you'll observe, that frequently black people, for some inexplicable reason, they just have difficulties passing the test. And again, it could, they'll say, well, the bell curve, you know, niggers just aren't that intelligent, you know. And you hear enough of that, and you see enough of those times where you don't pass the exam, you start to believe, like, yeah, I guess I'm just not that smart. I just, that must be the case. Or I guess black people in general maybe just aren't that smart, because it seems like a lot of us can't pass. In my view, no. System of white supremacy. And in fact, Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, he has, I think it's a video where he's talking about this very subject, the disparity in test scores. And he said that there's some evidence when black people start to close the gap on some of these tests, they go and they change the test up. And I mean, 5 points? Like, come on. Like, that's... Young academic has talked about this with us for some years, with workplace racism and going and study. This is not someone who loafs about his job, cares about his student, dedicated to his craft, being an educator, going and doing all the extra little projects to go and prepare and all this so that you can do well on the exam. And 5 points? That's the type, I think even Dr. Umar was saying, like, we don't know who's grading, what kind of discretion they have. I don't know if there's any sort of essay, because I think we had talked about that. I just don't remember if they have an essay portion of this. But I mean, wow, you talk about discretion. I mean, if this is anything other than A, B, C, if it's any type of writing in this, pff, 5 points.
The writing, I'm sorry to interrupt you. The writing portion is the portion that I keep failing on.
Of course.
It's a constructed response answer. And what ends up happening is, I'm really good at the multiple choice. I end up blowing through the multiple choice really, really fast. And I have about like 20 minutes. Instead of giving me that 20 minutes to use on my writing portion, they stop the time there. And I only have 30 minutes to write two constructed response essays. And the problem I'm having is, this goes back to my education. When I was in school, my school did not have enough money to afford computers, so most of our writing was done out by hand using outlines and stuff like that. Whenever I decide to write something, I formulate my ideas on paper, and then I go into type, since typing is so it's like foreign. It's unfamiliar, and that's usually like the last stage of my the writing process. I proofread my work, and I'm usually typing the paper. But what ends up happening to me, every time when I try to proofread my work, and the interface on a computer is like older and it's different. I use an Apple, so it's certain buttons and functions on an Apple that work, and on this computer it does not work. You can't even copy and paste, like, because I'm supposed to quote something from the selected essay that they give me, well, the writing prompt that they give me, and put it back in the piece. And I'm not even able to copy and paste it. And the computer ends up shutting off on me every single time. And I'm not able to reread my work. Now, if I had a disability, the test basically would not be timed. But being that I lack a disability, my tests are timed. And this is the section I score the same thing every single time. I receive a 6 out of 12 points. And the tests are graded on they're graded by teachers that get paid on how many tests that they grade in that day. So it's actually an incentive to like read through essays, right, and get as much graded as possible so you can receive a monetary incentive.
Discretion. You mentioned that word a lot in the system of white supremacy. I'm not sure if you've, you know, exhausted this avenue, but I do know some non-white people who have been able to successfully get that disability recognition where they could get more time. I don't know if you've exhausted that avenue, but I would try to pursue that in getting that disability, because sometimes that can just be a matter of words, because it could be concentration issue. I have heard some people who pursued that where they have difficulty concentrating and just use language around attention deficit disorder type of a thing, and they were able to get that recognized as a disability so they get additional time for tests and academics, things of that nature. So might be if you have not exhausted that already. We'll see some of our other listeners if they have any suggestions. I know we do have educators. If you have any suggestions about that exam or your own thoughts you would like to share, other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Hello, may I be heard?
Greetings, Irie in Louisiana.
Salutations, Gus, and salutations to everyone on the call. So, during the interview about Prada, I think there was a non-white Asian female talking. I found it interesting that she said she didn't want to be confronted by the images of the menstrual images when she's, ambulating around the city. And it's just funny, so the pictures, even the pictures are attacking you. It was just weird. I thought that what she said, but interesting. So I guess she gets a VGQ, I think. I have an opinion that I was listening to your broadcast on Super Bowl Sunday, and you all were talking about the Super Bowl in New Orleans, and it came up again. And I have an opinion that blackout, the NFL is too powerful of an industry and an entity to not have some sort of secondary and tertiary backup for any of its, anything necessary to operate that game fully and broadcast it or allow the players to play. For the most part. So I find it interesting that there was a blackout. And I feel like they did that purposefully because growing up, in New Orleans, over time I heard that people would refer to it as the city that Kara forgot. And also, after Katrina and everything, with everything that happened with the people that were stuck there, it certainly did look like the city that Kara forgot or anybody forgot. So there's just this overlay of haphazardness and malaise and, poor planning that the city has a reputation for as it is. And I think that was done purposefully to reinforce that. I could be incorrect. And then the diversity directors at Prada and everywhere else, H&M and whoever, it's a facade because as a graphic designer, I know personally from my training, self-training and in school, you get to a certain point that you find out that in American history, during those antebellum times and during the post, whatever it would be called, time, post-Civil War and emancipation time, that there was specific and purposeful propaganda against non-white African people in this country. You're not unfamiliar with that as a designer of any sort, fashion, photography. It's a lie that they don't know. They're ignorant. But, white people love to know that they subjugate non-white people. And I guess the Asian lady was confused as to why a brand wouldn't want non-white people wearing their stuff. But they know why they don't want it. And they also know that if they do bring somebody to do the diversity, it's probably going to be a white person. So it's just, I feel like that almost didn't deserve an article almost. I mean, it was revealing, but it's like it's such a waste of time for people to pretend like they're actually going to try to, you know, be inclusive or whatever. It's just stupid. And I'll, I did hear the tail end of the caller before me about something about a percentage of a point. I didn't hear it all because I had to switch calls and switch back. I just recently found out that racism has struck again at my son's high school because he was actually like 4 points away from making the Honor Society, the National Honor Society, for the first quarter. And he appealed to the teacher where the deficit was to just bump him up because he said, you know, he felt he got it meritoriously. I work really hard. I've been up late. I've turned things on time. Can you just give me that extra percentage? And he told him no, because he didn't earn it. And I'm like, and then frustration, anger, and I'll mute my line for now. Thank you.
By design system of white supremacy, I know myself, I recall going to school, and there were many, many instances where white women, white girls, white boys, they would be in the same situation, you know, really need to get an A. I'm trying to get in the, you know, honor society, or trying to get into my number one pick for my colleges. And, you know, I've really got to have that high GPA. And, you know, can you put anything I could do to get that extra point? Like, I would see this and it would be, oh, man, sure, no problem. We'll, you know, make up a little extra credit assignment, or sometimes just, you know, sure, no problem. That would be it. Like, all discretion, word I used before. I've seen that throughout. Not just, in fact, I said girls and boys. Let me retract, because I saw that like K through 12 and beyond, even, you know, in the academy, where it would be the exact same thing with just let me think of the best one. Undergrad, 4-year college down at University of California, Berkeley, one of their prestigious schools, they say. White woman that I worked with, she said she had mental health crisis and had to take a little time away from school. She was taking a three credit class. She did not complete the final exam, final project. She didn't turn it in. She didn't do. She comes back like a year. It was more than a year after the class, like a year and a half after the class. She comes back, contacts, and she confesses to all of this. Contacts the professor and is like, you know, hey, had mental health crisis, needed some time away from college, you know, what can I do to make up the final project and exam? Mind you that during this year and a half of mental crisis, she took this time to take a cruise, went to Greece, Australia, work on her tan. Anyway, the professor says, oh, hey, I know you worked really hard in class. No problem. I'll go ahead and give you an A. I'm not saying that happens for every single white person every single time, but that is not that whole cheating scandal that we just talked about. The whole, put that up, young academic. I know he's taken this exam multiple times. Like I said, dedicated to his craft to be an educator, and I'm going to go learn. I'm going to go do extra studying and blah, 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 and all that. The cheating scandal. Well, this went on for years. We're just making it up. Yeah, I was in Honor Society. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Equestrian, all that. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Just to get in and then find out, oh, no, I've been sitting on the couch eating Cheetos for the last 5 years. Couldn't even spell equestrian. Context to white supremacy. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. To young academic, with taking those tests. When I started studying something called the trivium quadrivium, because logic was one of the seven liberal arts. Once I saw logic and I know that this is a logic-based system, I said, well, this has to apply to white supremacy. So I started studying it. And what I've learned is multiple choice and true and false, those deductive reasoning type of logic that they teach to black people in public schools and things of that nature, to people who can afford private education or more elite affluent whites, they learn inductive reasoning, which is question asking and things of that nature. So when you have to write an essay, that's inductive reasoning, true and false and multiple choice, that's deductive reasoning. So they learn how to fill in the blank. They don't get to have a little ABCD. You know, the question is the blank said wolf. You know, they have to put dog there. It's not going to say A, cat, B, pig. You know, they learn a totally different way. And I think that that is why they do a lot better on standardized tests. The clip you played, Gus, with the mascot, the mascots, the Indian names. I remember when St. John's was called the Redmen, and now they're called the Red Storm, because the indigenous population of Native American, you know, population didn't want them using that name. To me, that goes along the lines of the statues. You know, like, until we solve the problem, you know, is it really worth exuding your energy on? I mean, in fact, Minnesota, Chicago, Manhattan, all named after, you know, the indigenous people, and it hasn't changed anything. It just, to me, it's just something that we shouldn't be focused on. The white guy at the student meeting clip, that was my type of racist, very forthcoming. And I agree that the training classes won't get white, change white people's mindset. He was very honest, in my opinion, with that. However, I do disagree that those trainings are a waste of time for white people. He said that. I don't agree with that, because those classes and trainings do an excellent job at teaching white people how to be better racist. Hands-on professional training by experienced racists and confused victims, unfortunately, give them racist tools and techniques on how to be more deceptive, more confusing, you know, white supremacy refinement classes, you know, how to better refine their practices. I also agree with what you said about the Mexican man as well. You know, they have a homeland. They're discontent with the very minor racist treatment that their people have endured compared to, you know, our experience, then they should go back to where they came from. Well, that's my opinion. We didn't get sanctuary cities. We got sundown towns. Let's put blackface on the white books. I thought that was a good clip. Hollywood, to me, does the same thing. How many times do you see a black movie, but they're just reenacting a white movie? You know, Blackula and The Wiz instead of The Wizard Oz, just some of the things that they do. I think that would have been very good to promote black authors and books that are in the genre of fantasy and horror and sci-fi that we don't get any exposure in, really. That would have been nice for Black History Month. Maybe black person creates the Black Harry Potter and becomes a big success, but it's overlooked due to the system of white supremacy. A few years ago, I said the NFL had a marketing problem and had needed more hip-hop, and I think they listened, hired Jay-Z, and they have a even bigger health problem. The man said in a clip, they don't want youth to play football before high school. That's a big, big problem for the NFL, because they want the best players, and generally you start at Pop Warner, 7, 8, It's not like basketball, baseball, hockey, where you have a surplus of international players. Football is solely a North American game. Canada and North America and the United States are really the only two places where it's big. They can't admit to being the cause of CTE because then they'll have to pay. And then they also have to take responsibility for fixing it at the same time because they know it exists and it's going to cost them. So tonight I saw they had an XFL game. I had never heard of it. Didn't know it existed until tonight. I read about it, but I didn't think it was real. And very deceptive. I think this is the NFL trying to fix the CTE problem. They're implementing new rules. They have different equipment in this XFL, and they're able to experiment with it without actually putting the NFL moniker on it and being responsible for it. So they're able to do a test, and that's why they're not shutting this down, in my opinion. And I'll mute my line for now, Gus. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Speaking of the so-called blackface, where they would take in the books and just putting a black face on them, they have the same thing. The Seattle Children's Theater, they have a production of Snow White. And it's, to me, it just looks bizarre. But the billboard, they have a billboard for this. And it has a picture of a black female. And she's Snow White. And she's taking a bite out of an apple. And it just looks peculiar at minimum every time I see it. But that's the Seattle Children's Theater right now. And they might have a black actress playing Snow White. That could be the case, but similar, unless I'm mistaken. Other folks that we have missed completely, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Imhan DC.
Yes, sir. Greetings. And greetings to everyone. Wanted to say, again and again, I'm an American, and white people have to leave America, have to leave Africa, have to leave Australia, have to leave every country that they've come to invade. And I wanted to speak about the test scores and these people. I've taken my broker exam, I think, 4 times. I've passed it 3 times. I passed it the first time. It'd be a longer story than what I really want to say to explain everything. But I passed it the first time, but my broker wouldn't give me my license for this or that reason. Well, she wouldn't give me my license. And then, so I had to wait another, I think, 2 years. I passed it again. And then she gave me my license based on the same work experience that I had done the previous period up to my exam, if I'm making sense. As in, there was no reason for her to have not allowed me to get my broker's license, but she has her discretion. She can choose to or not to. And then, so I said, I took it 4 times. So something happened. I'm trying to even remember, but I'm not going to. And I had to take it again. I passed. Okay, now I'm on my 3rd time. I failed it once by 1 question. By 1 question. And I, you know, just reviewing it in my head when I after I had failed it, I was angry because I I know this information. I've passed it too many times, and. The way they have it set up is that there are some questions. There's not a correct answer. There's not a correct answer, and so they have this formula. There's some questions that there's not a correct answer, and then so maybe they'll give everybody who took the test this extra point or whatever. And then there's some questions that are, they don't really expect you to get correct or incorrect. There is a correct answer, but because it's so advanced or it's something that they didn't have on the study portion, this is all exams. They have this type of structure where, anyway, I think I passed even that exam. I immediately took it again, you know, in whatever time frame they gave, and I passed it. But it is more likely that we will end white supremacy with white people being away from us, out of our country, than it is that we will end white supremacy by changing white people's mind and keeping them right beside us in our same country, in our same land. It will be more difficult for white people to kill us if they are not in America, if they are not in Africa, if they are not in Australia. South America is America. If they're not in all these other places in the world, it will be a little more difficult to shoot us in the head or any other part of our body. It will be a little more difficult to do the chemtrails because they have to fly planes every single day, constantly during the day and the night. They have to fly it in a certain pattern. They have to do it in every single city. In order to make it cold, it was just 70-something degrees. And then it went to snow in the next 2 days or something. And I heard, Thomas, I did hear you make mention of the things that they're putting in the chemtrails. Me and my brother were standing outside the next maybe 2 days, and I started inhaling, and I could taste salt. I could taste sea salt, seawater. And I was telling my brother, is it just me, or do you also taste this? And he said, yeah, I do taste it. And so we went in. Anyway, all the chemicals that they're putting in the sky has to come back down, and it's killing us. It's so cold, I'm shivering, but it was just 70-something degrees. White people cannot survive in the regular weather that is in America. If there were no chemtrails, white people would die. That's why they're doing chemtrails. I say chemtrails is the most important thing, one of the most important things that we need to focus on. White people, yeah, but they're able to survive with these chemtrails. We have to end white supremacy as soon as possible. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan DC.
I had a really good morning with you.
Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Yes, sir. We can hear you. Just wanted to make sure I got the number out one more time.
Okay. Justice to everybody that's listening. Justice and respect. To the host too. So none of the things I looked up online are Yoga Alliance certified. So, and they cost a lot more money than I thought. I guess that was the initial plan. Was the, like, when you first start off with them, and then when you continue getting the rest of their products, it goes up to like $1,000-something. But it's still not Yoga Alliance certified, so I can't use it everywhere. So I have to go to like one of these expensive places that you were talking about. So that's one thing. Second, I feel like it's hard for me to explain how I feel, but I'm gonna try. It's like the more knowledge I get, the more depressed I get. The more I learn, the more I look around, I realize everybody around me have no idea, no clue about what's going on. The word white supremacy is not in anybody's vocabulary unless they hear it on TV or something. And I become the guy that keeps talking about things. Now I'm the guy telling people, trying to help people eat better. Now I'm the vegan. Now I'm the guy telling people to read. Everybody around me is in their 30s, early 30s, mid-30s. People are having fun. They're trying to travel. They're trying to see the world. Everybody's enjoying everything. and I'm not enjoying anything. And it's becoming very hard for me to live like this. But I'm still living, of course, but it's very difficult. So I would like to know what everybody, what some ideas on how to make this a little easier. Because everything is against us in every area of activity. I can't even eat in peace. The food is not real. So I don't know what to do at this point. I'm reading. I'm doing yoga 3 times a day. I'm meditating. And I'm still stressed. I don't find enjoyment from everything that I used to enjoy. I don't enjoy anything anymore. And that's all I have to say. Thank you, guys. I'll sit down and listen to what you guys got to say before we close.
Much obliged. That is good information. I remember you telling us about the online yoga program and thinking that it was cheaper and then finding out it's more costly and then that it's not Yoga Alliance certified, which sometimes can matter to white people.
White supremacy.
Absolutely. But I guess, you know, you can do some more research with the new information and figure out what will be the best choice if you want to find a studio. There are some studios that are at least operated by black people, so you would have a black trainer and maybe more black students. I can maybe send some information to you about that if you send me an email. Untiljustice@gmail.com. To the other portion of your commentary about not getting any enjoyment and kind of being labeled the vegan guy and the white supremacy guy, I can certainly relate to that. I suspect some of our other folks here have as well. Generally speaking, you know, I think I've said for a while, I don't proselytize about anything. Yoga, eating well, counter-racism. I generally try to leave people alone and meet them where they're at. Now, I like traveling. Now, if they're talking about traveling, I would talk about traveling. It's been my experience that racism will come up on its own. Once people know that you are someone that's interested in that, give it enough time, racism will come up somehow, some way. Somebody will say that Kobe Bryant is a rapist or whatever it is. Somebody will do something to them on their job. That's when I found people are more receptive than just, you know, trying to talk about it when they don't want to, when they don't bring it up. That's been my experience as well. When you bring it up and they haven't brought it up, oh man, you hate white people. Oh man, you are racist. Oh, there you go again. We can't even sit down and enjoy it. Like, that's very,
can I,
very.
Can I jump in right quick?
I reckon.
Can I jump in right quick?
I reckon.
Okay. Well, I don't try to talk to people about anything. This is my life. This is how I live. I've been living like this for a very long time now, because I'm not born here. So basically, I have a different mindset. I come from a place where there was a revolution, one revolution. It happened one place ever in life where black people got rid of white people out their land. And they're the poorest place in the Western Hemisphere because of that. So I grew on growing up with that mentality. So I've always been a part of me. I've always been different. I've always been somebody that's a revolutionary, what they will call a revolutionary, using that word, that term. So that's just how I move. But the people around me, it's like I have to help them. I feel that way because they're the people that need the most help. I don't want to talk to people who went to college because they don't need the help. They have all the information in front of them. They don't want to learn. My cousin is a college professor. He knows everything. I don't want to talk to him. I want to talk to the person in the hood that don't know nothing at all. That's who needs the most help. That's who Neely Fuller said needs the most help. The people that need the most help, that's who's supposed to be helping. So I can't, and on the traveling thing, I don't want to travel. I'm good right here. I don't have no money. I don't want to go to other places and stay in hotels and live like I'm rich, but then come back home and be poor again. But I'm living better than people that's in third world countries. That's okay with me. I'm good here. I'm a third world country person here. I can't even go to Times Square and go stay in a hotel. You know what I'm saying? So I don't want to go somewhere outside another country, save up some money and do that. That's a waste of money. I ain't trying to travel like that. I'll go to the yoga retreat, though.
May 21 to May 24, Toronto. That logical, I can grasp in terms of who you want to help the most, who needs the most help. That makes sense. I would watch the word help. I think Mr. Edward Williams, counter-racism.com, I spoke with him. This was some years back. And it was similar, talking to other black people about racism, and they were resistant or weren't receptive, put it that way. And I said, trying to help share counter racism. And he said, I would watch that word help. If people have not stated that, hey, Gus, I'm trying to get some information on counter racism. Can you help me out with that? If that's not what they've asked for, then you're not helping. You're just, offering something that they can reject, they can accept or no. And that's, I think, the approach. I think it helping people who need the most help, great. What I have found with those folks, if there are specific things, specific problems that they have, if you can help with those specific problems, outstanding, then they will be a little bit more receptive if you have other things like eating vegan plant-based food, counter-racism, doing a little yoga. They might be a little bit more receptive to that. That's been my experience, just trying to just talk to people cold turkey about racism or putting down Cheetos. Actually, the food thing kind of depends. That people are much more receptive to food. That's been my experience. Like that, depending on who the person is, if that's something that they already feel like. See, now that's the other thing. With food, I found that people frequently, many more black people I'll bump into will say, oh, yeah, I have a food problem, and if you have anything helpful on that, any tidbits, let me know. I would like to hear about that right now. That is not the case with counter-racism.
I lost 100 pounds, so everybody wants to know what's going on.
That has been my experience. People will do that if they've seen that, and or even if you haven't lost 100 pounds, if it just seems like you are kind of fit and you are eating okay, hey, they might check you out on that. They might get sit down and be courteous and listen to you for 30 minutes. Very different about racism, white supremacy. That's why I generally wouldn't start there. I would just try and basic things. If you can help them solve some problems, if it's doing some yoga, getting their diet together, that's something that they have a problem and they're receptive to, do that. Do it courteously. They see some results. Then, hey, maybe we can move along to racism. That's been my experience. But they're not getting, I think someone asked Dr. Welsing about that some years back in terms of not getting joy out of things anymore. And that's totally understandable. The system of white supremacy is designed to kind of suck that enjoyment out of everything. What I would say is to at least try to find a few things. I just talked about this yesterday in terms of workplace racism and just being angry all the time. It's not good for your system. Everything that I know, just being constantly in a state of rage or frustration about people not being receptive to wanting to solve this problem and wasting time on silliness and just constantly seeing racism everywhere, which I do. I would say try to find something where you can get a few moments to just relax from that. If it's the yoga helps, the meditation, try to find something, because, man, that is just not good for your body to have that sort of tension constantly. I know that to be the case for myself. That's why I try to do my yoga today before we got on the program, just to try to release from that, because that's what the system has designed for us to be angry and frustrated all the time. And medical apartheid, that's a part of it right there. So if other folks have suggestions that they can offer either on the frustration of this, just not feeling like you get any joy out of anything anymore, just seeing, understanding white supremacy, racism in all areas of people activity, and then trying to share with other people, and maybe they're not too receptive to what you have to say about race, that you become the white supremacy guy, the militant black person. I think we've heard that a few times. If folks have suggestions.
Hello.
Let's see. That's Irie in Louisiana.
Yeah. I was in your shoes because people were saying, you're extreme, you're militant, you're whatever. And I also realized that part of that response was because they didn't ask for the information that I was volunteering. And listening to Mr. Fuller and speaking with him only twice, but still having very, very dynamic conversations about things with my son, what I learned from those conversations can be applied to anyone. A person is learning when they ask questions. So if a person doesn't ask you questions, I wouldn't volunteer that information
because it will come across like what Gus was saying, like you're, you know, preaching or evangelizing to them, and they didn't. You don't want to come across like, you know, the Mormons do or the Jehovah's Witnesses. Oh, here they come, here he comes, you know, because now they're closed to anything that would be constructive that you could share with them that they would benefit from. And I agree with Gus. People who have needs, once they express to you a need and you can help them with that, then help them with that and leave it at that. And maybe it'll develop more curiosity, but just help them where they're at. And I would also tell you to decide to enjoy something. You're going to have to make a choice to enjoy something, because if not, you're actually countering the counter-racism that you want to practice. Being unhappy and depressed and cynical is also a byproduct that's desired in the system of racism, white supremacy. So even though you understand better than you did before, and it does make you unhappy about what you're understanding, choose something that can negate that distress and duress in you. One of the most neutral things I've done other than exercise is starting to get back into nature. So even this spring coming up, we got a garden plot. I'm planting all the beautiful colors that's going to be in my garden. And, yes, I talk to these flowers. And that helps me. So maybe it's that. Maybe it's learning, you know, how to write poetry or something. But please make a decision to enjoy something so your work in counter-racism isn't negated by undue stress. And I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Irie in Louisiana. I will give out the number again. It is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Other folks who have a hand up, if you have comments, suggestions, questions, line should be open. Proceed.
Oh, hi. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hi. I just want to follow up with the first caller when he was talking about his deficiencies in his school. And his schoolwork. I know of some websites that websites where it could help him with his studies. I can send an email to you, Gus, and maybe you could pass it to him.
Okie dokie. That would be appreciated. I'm sure young academic would appreciate that.
And I also just wanted to After he was making his comments about his schooling, I just thought that it kind of connected to the Kobe Bryant situation when the principal at a high school made the comments that Kobe's death was karma. And then I just thought to myself, wow, if a principal of a high school said that, and then they're teaching non-white children, they can just decide not to teach them anything. So that would probably be one of the reasons why, you know, the first caller may have said, I don't know if he said this exactly, that he had defects in his schooling. So I was just saying, like, If a principal of a school would say something like that, and then, you know, they may not even be teaching non-white children anything, and this person has all these racist ideas and phobias about Black people and anti-Blackness, that's one of the reasons, you know, that maybe the kids are not really learning anything. And then when they grew up to become adults, you know, like us, they can't really solve their problems because they haven't been able to develop their thinking processes. They haven't developed the ability to know how to solve their problems. And because of that, that's why we end up becoming dependent on white people to solve our problems instead of us solving our own problems. So I just thought that when the caller was talking about his schoolwork and his difficulties, I just thought how that kind of connected with the Kobe Bryant comment from the principal. I don't know if that makes any sense.
That is the whole system, and anchored by a white woman, or I won't say anchored, that's a metaphor, but the principal in this case was a white woman who made those comments about it being karma, Kobe Bryant's death. But that is the system, the academy system of white supremacy racism. Absolutely. I think Young Academic, he said when he was talking about the 5 points, it was, he said on the test, was the margin in them saying, oh, no, you didn't quite pass. That he said in growing up in the schools that he went to, that they didn't have teachers who had, you know, impeccable credentials and graduated from Ivy League schools and Phi Beta Kappa and all that. He said they had a lot of substitute teachers. I suspect he probably went to a school, or at least the classes that he was in probably had more non-white students. It probably wasn't an environment where it was bunches and bunches of children classified as white. That is not an accident. That is by design, exactly as you said. So you end up with non-white so-called adults who are not well-informed, don't have the best thinking skills to solve problems, don't have even the best information and or problem-solving skills. And that is all by design, absolutely. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, if we missed you totally, if we missed you completely, you should get a hand up. We have about 15 minutes left in the broadcast.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. Dr. Welsing was known to have quoted, when the student is ready, a teacher will appear. I think it's logical, and it makes sense, and it would reduce arguing, fussing, and fighting that we do on most subjects. So that may be that's a suggestion that I would have for someone who gets frustrated over quote unquote dumb black folks, because all of you guys are listening to one right now. Number two, exchange of views. I've had a constructive exchange of views with my yoga instructor at the Betty T. Ferguson Community Center. And out of that discussion, she has become interested into bringing her son to the next DCF program session. I may try to convince Mr. Clark also to every now and then have her to come over and instruct the young fellas into some yoga, since she's a certified instructor, former public school teacher herself. DCF mentoring program is near its ending, which accumulates with, I guess the best way to describe it becomes a banquet. They're also getting instructions on the means of etiquette within, you know, business structures. If you are applying for a job and there's a job interview and that sort of thing. Also, there will be some recognition that goes out to some of the fellas who have really dedicated themselves to the different principles that Mr. Clark has pointed out as far as points of interest with the program itself about different things that he has that are important, and some of the guys excelled on. I heard someone mention about speaking to the plants. Well, the great George Washington Carver, he professed was one of his main attributes into all of the things that we utilize today that he got from plants. He said his quote unquote secret was talking to the plants, getting up early in the morning and going into the forest and talking to the plants. That was a quote from the great George Washington Carver. The only thing I would say on the Kobe Bryant issue over the latest report, it seems to be a lot of vitriol, toxic, was not as much anyway when a white person says something disparaging about us, but we can easily be sparked into doing that with each other. It doesn't take much at all. I have not found any constructive outcome that comes from that at all. Basically, codified response is, he said what he said, she said what she said. And I think the person that was being interviewed conducted herself in a codified manner. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Other folks that we have missed totally, if you have commentary you would like to share, lines should be open. Proceed. Did we nab everybody? Everybody have opportunity to share? Didn't miss anybody?
Yeah, I'd be heard.
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I wanted to start out with in the local news, I have been seeing quite a bit of the Black History Month events going on. Most recently, there was an event for Black children to come into, I think it was one of the libraries, and read some of the literature and storybooks with Black characters, and it looked very constructive to me. And from the report, it said that the children learned a lot of lessons from history and things concerning about racism. So it was interesting to see that kind of a news report, because I haven't seen it in recent years. And they are apparently doing a Black History Month segment every Tuesday throughout the month of February. So I'm going to continue to look at those reports. As far as the audio segment, that one where I think the non-white person was saying how his son was crying, and the suspected racist just came out and asked the question and something about why aren't you still in Mexico or something. You know, I do agree that that is a blatant racist, not trying to be refined. And I think that's a part of a lesson of how to learn how to respond, you know, with logic, you know, just saying, hey, I just want to be here or whatever, you know, and just saying like, we have to expect that kind of behavior. And for them to turn around and say, hey, well, you know, you need to leave. No, he doesn't need to leave. He needs to stay. Like, that's racism right there. This is why we're all in this room. So, that would be my approach. But I also have to understand that a lot of non-white people are confused about racism, and that's the correct approach to at least try to get into a environment like that to have a discussion. So I found that very interesting, and I think that may have been a white woman saying she thought that he was a white supremacist, because the guy was saying, well, hey, you can defend your race or something. Well, how come I can't defend mine? But, like, he has to clarify and elaborate on what that means. Like, what do you mean I'm defending my race? I'm reporting mistreatment. I'm trying to bring about balance. Like, I shouldn't have to deal with this. My children shouldn't have to deal with this going to school. And you asking me, you know, what geographical location I need to be. But, yeah, she said that he is a white supremacist because he acts like he thinks that he is superior, his group is superior to another group of people, when I didn't necessarily hear him say that, but he is practicing racism, though. So as you've mentioned before, like, definitions are important, especially in that kind of an environment like that, where, you know, emotion is, you know, prone to be displayed like that. And for the caller that was mentioning about not getting any joy in anything, I would just recommend like finding some kind of a hobby or something that you at some point may enjoy, or you just want to just maybe do something that involves like building something or finishing something, like reading a book or like learning, as you mentioned, Gus, vegan recipes and finding a way to put something together. I think that can build someone's patience and having an understanding of that it takes time for people to learn, especially about a problem like racism. So that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. It does take time for people to learn about the problem, racism, white supremacy, and white people even contribute to that, adding incorrect information and Timothy Wise and the rest of it to it, to make that difficult so that we don't actually learn, so that we have to unlearn all of their lies and confusion in the process. But that, great, great. I have enjoyed cooking as well. I didn't do as much cooking, but doing more vegan cooking, I have enjoyed that immensely, doing constructive things. Other folks, if we missed you completely, you should definitely speak now because we have about 5 minutes. But anybody else, any last comment, question, suggestion before we depart? Thomas in New York.
Yes. Yeah, I don't believe Gail or Oprah and their reaction to the backlash from the Kobe interview. It just wasn't genuine, in my opinion. Because I've noticed a pattern of behavior, of anti-black behavior from them. Cosby to R. Kelly, Michael Jackson, Russell Simmons, Monique. You know, it just seems like it's an ongoing pattern. And I do not see the equity in Kevin Spacey, Ed Bucks, Harvey Weinstein, Jeffrey Epstein. There's no interview of Sandusky victims or Holzclaw victims. You know, it just seems like it's always focused on black males and females. This just reported on the news here in New York that there was a cop that was shot this evening in the Bronx. He was shot in the neck and chin. However, he's going to survive, it seems like. He was shot in a park, policeman. The mayor, the chief of police, and the police union head, very racist male, very outspoken racist, were given a press conference, and I wasn't really listening to them. But they were, what I could hear was they was pretty much asking for, you know, New Yorkers to show empathy for this cop who was shot. And this was in the Bronx, which is only 11% white, non-Spanish speaking white. So that should tell you that it's just not the most served borough of the five, the least served by white supremacy. Just a couple of days ago, in contrast, a legal alien was shot It seemed like this person was involved in a felony before, and he had recently been arrested again. So the ICE department came looking for him, and they went to arrest him, and people tried to stop them, and someone got shot that was not armed. And I never saw this before, but the mayor came out, and he said the ICE wasn't real police, and he doesn't want them in New York, and they should be arrested, and this guy should be treated like a civilian who shot another person. And I just never saw, it's just the irony now, in a New York City police officer. This is somehow a real police officer now. There was a cop that had went to a victim's house responding to a domestic violence call, and he ended up raping that victim later that evening. And he was skipped. He pleaded guilty to the crime, and in his sentencing, his father stood up and said that terrible things happened to cops in jail, and he doesn't want his son to go to jail.
30 seconds.
The judge gave him no jail time, and I'll mute my line.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Discretion, even in sentencing. Discretion. Mm. No one cares about raping black females, black males, black children. We have about 60 seconds. Other folks have commentary that they want to share before we conclude.
Something happened and I got booted from the line, just so you know, technical glitch. I was just going to suggest one other thing. Get a pet. You can talk to them too, and they love that. So thanks. Good night, everybody.
Can I be heard real quick?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Thank you for everybody for their suggestions. Most of your suggestions I'm already doing. I don't need a pet. I have a child. That's enough. And I'm doing music and all that. I have a whole studio. I make music. I made two albums already. This is what I do. I do music. I'm just saying, like, my research and studies and things like that have made me a little depressed, you know, because I see the things happening in a 360. Everything that happened in history is coming back and happening again, and people don't know these things or don't care. So that's what kind of frustrated me, because I already know it's coming. But, you know, that's it. But thank you, everybody, for the suggestion.
Dr. Welsing, she did say, be not discouraged. I know it definitely can be frustrating, but be not
discouraged. I just read her prayer.
The Grandcester. Is everybody good? Anything else folks need to get in before we conclude?
Oh, hi. I just want to make a suggestion. There's a breath exercise that I've learned. It's called the 4-7-8 breath, where you breathe in for 4 seconds, hold your breath for 7 seconds, and breathe out for 8 seconds. And you keep doing this over and over and over, probably like 15 times. Well, I probably need it for 15 times. Anyway, and you just do it over and over. As time goes by, you'll slowly relax, you know, and you forget what's upsetting you and stuff like that. And you could do yoga, like someone else suggested. And just listen to YouTube, you know, you from Dr. Francis Russing, you know, and that I find that really helps. And Mr. Fuller.
Much obliged. That's pretty much our 3 hours. We'll stop here. You can check Black Talk Radio Network and the Facebook page for our upcoming broadcasts. I had delivery problems. One of our listeners suggested the book Masterless Men. It's written by a white woman, Carrie Lee Merritt. And for some reason, the book took forever to get here. I have had that happen before sometimes with packages for some reason, where they took a long time to arrive. But I have the book now, and so we're just trying to get the date together. Always grand to speak with white people. But we'll update dates and times, all that. Check Black Talk Radio Network and Facebook. With that, thanks everyone for listening. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. Young academic talking about his family member, ancestor, who was on a plantation where she was raped breeding plantation. There's a lot of information on that in the Slave Coast. Ned and Constance Sublett, they were guests on the Cows in February 2016, about a year ago, almost to the day, or four years ago to the date. We discussed their book, The Slave Coast, which is all about the importance of those breeding plantations and raping black people in the system of white supremacy. Very constructive book. Anywho, with that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy racism. Preserve your brain computer. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle. If you are driving, you are sober, buckled up, and not on the cell phone. Let's do all that we can to try to stay as safe as possible under conditions of white supremacy. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.